WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another broadcast of America's longest-running talk show. That's right, right here on WRIF, where it began. 43 years ago this month. Uh-huh. Julene Jordan, how are you?
Excellent, Peter.
John Miller is off on vacation.
We have Candy next door. Thank you, Candy, for coming in. She's going to be taking your calls. And by the way, Candy doesn't take any crap from anyone. So.
Hey, well, no, don't put out any challenges. If you got a beef.
I'm just saying, leave her alone.
No challenges. If you got a beef, call Julene and me.
True, though.
313-298-WRIF, which is...
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to contact us by email, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short comments preferred, and we may read them on the air. If you're on the Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall, always lots of good stuff there. And you can see photographs of me and Julene. And then there's photographs of Julene and other photographs of me. And then some other photographs.
It's a big band. And I'm going to be a little more active on Facebook because I graduated from culinary school.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. I'm also known as Chef Julene now. And but we'll still be doing this radio show and the other radio shows that I do here at Greater Media.
And I know I'm never supposed to sing on the air, but if there's this like 30s song or maybe even from the 20s, hey, good looking. What you got cooking? Sure. How about cooking something up with me?
Yeah. Okay, it's time to do a lot of things. Culinary school is a grind. It was a long few years, and I'm done. So now there will be more time for me to play on Facebook and be political.
Well, you can also if you need a hog butchered. Give Julene a call.
Oh, please don't. I witnessed that, and I don't really care to do it again.
All right. Well, if the Middle East doesn't explode tonight, we'll get on to other stuff. Israel has bombed Baghdad, who knows what's going to happen? Everybody is not Baghdad. Sorry.
Excuse me, Peter. Yeah. Did you see the look on my face?
Yeah, I wondered why.
Well, I thought, wait a minute, I missed something really big, and I pay attention.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
Let's go back.
Yeah. Israel.
Bomb the capital of Syria, Damascus, twice in the last 2 days.
Still bad.
Thank you.
Still.
What if you weren't here?
I don't know, because you would have started the whole conspiracy thing. People would have said,
but this is all getting out of hand.
It's not a laughing matter.
Yeah. You know, this all goes back. I'm not gonna go back with it, but this all goes back to like 19th century colonialism and The attempt to control the Middle East for all of its oil and resources and other stuff like that. But let's not do that. You know, let's talk about the new normal. The new normal is, I remember.
Which is not just a television show. That's another television show. But I've never seen it.
What's it about? Never mind. I don't care.
I think it's about diversity. But I really don't know.
Okay. We'll forget that. But I was coming in. Remember, I came in. You were on the air yesterday, and I came in to do some stuff for the show.
Yeah.
And so the first news story was that 7 or 8 Americans had been killed in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then also 2 teens were shot and wounded in Mount Clemens, somebody wielding a 9mm pistol. And then half of the east side of Detroit was shut down because they found a suitcase that they thought might have a bomb in it. And the day before, a very well-loved basketball coach of a girls' basketball team was just assassinated for some reason. And I'm thinking, it's draining. I'm just off to work. And yet we are becoming accustomed to this being what passes for our normal life.
Yeah, it's as though we become numb to these horrible atrocities.
I don't know. It'd be interesting. And if there's anybody that has lived in a war zone anywhere from, and this time for real, Baghdad or London when the IRA was doing its bombing, I think it is. I think people, you just kind of have to go through your daily life and pretend that there's not a high increased risk of being taken out by some maniac wielding a bomb or a gun or whatever else.
Attempt to not live in fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how people do it
in Baghdad and think about Gaza and, oh my gosh.
Well, and this, a lot of this has come about because of what happened in Boston, the bombing of the Boston Marathon. And this is interesting. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, most people want him to be tried in a federal court rather than in a military court.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why anybody has a great opinion of it. For one thing,
it would be a military court. That confused me.
Well, these Republicans are trying to always say we're involved in this war against terrorism. It's not, it's like a war against drugs or a war against poverty. It's not a war. People that are going to exercise their political views by attacking civilians. It doesn't get much more horrible than that.
I mean, Bradley Manning being in a military court, even though I don't agree with it, makes sense because he was in the military.
They're doing that with what they call enemy combatants. But I don't understand. If you're an enemy combatant, like the United States routinely bombed civilians everywhere from World War II on.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean
at a rapid rate.
Yeah, I mean millions if you add up Korea and Vietnam, for instance, and thousands and thousands of people killed by
Iraq.
Yeah. So I mean, are those war crimes?
Pakistan.
Yeah. I don't get this. I mean, what if we're at war? Then people like, I even forgot his name. What's the guy that they waterboarded 147 times that admitted he was behind the 9/11?
Oh, I don't want to guess.
Yeah, neither do I. But isn't he just then a prisoner of war? I mean, how can you be tried for what all nations do routinely when they're at war? They've reversed the equation. It used to be 80% military casualties, 20% of
Sheikh
civilian.
Sheikh Al-Muhammad, was that what it was?
You're getting close. Sheikh is the first. Yes. Okay.
Anyway.
Hit the email, guys. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Anyway, so now, though, it's 80% civilians, 20% military. But regardless, also 70% said they believe Tsarnaev should be put to death if found guilty, which I think he's going to be found guilty.
I have a strong inkling he will be.
Yeah, that he's actually pled. He could very well plead guilty. I don't think he's going to suddenly say, you know what, I was a little under it when I said I did it, so I'm taking it back.
Well, and there's that whole situation about him not being read his rights.
Yeah,
it may come up.
Well, it may. It may. But this idea that 70% of people believe that Tsarnaev should be put to death, I mean, that's the idea of vengeance. And normally when it comes to, like, individual crimes of murder, well, it sort of depends the enormity of the crime, right? If there are three dead and 260 wounded, mm-hmm. then the number of people that think that the perpetrator ought to be similarly put to death grows. If it's a husband killing her wife. Wait a minute, is that right? Her husband, right? What's it
husband
go? Which way?
Killing his wife.
Yeah, husband killing his wife. Right. Yeah, most people are going to go, oh, it was a crime of passion. You know, get life in prison, it'll do it. Something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's still that one of the things that people say you can judge a society by how it deals with the people that are the least the most hated in a society. So, for instance, Massachusetts, to its credit, does not have
the death penalty.
The death penalty, just like the United States does not. I'm sorry. I'm doing about six things. My,
Michigan?
Michigan does not. Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got, if you could see what I have here, folks, I know.
It is a bit of a madhouse.
Yeah, don't,
I could take a picture and post it on Facebook.
I know, you want to hear a radio show, not excuses. But anyway, so 70% of people want vengeance, and the idea that the war has been brought home in the manner of 9/11, and this is sort of a small reflection, even given the extent of death and injuries, particularly the injuries of what the United States suffered on 9/11, it's a combination of vengeance, the hope that it'll be a deterrent, but it's not. I mean, if you're talking about people, I guess the brothers at one point even discussed doing suicide bombings. So you have people that are willing to forfeit their lives.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you find out, this poll said that Americans overwhelmingly favor installing video surveillance cameras in public places.
Well, they're just about everywhere anyway already.
Well, not like in Britain, for instance, where they are just absolutely everywhere. And they judge the infringement on our privacy as an acceptable trade-off for greater security from terrorist attacks. This is according to a New York Times poll. 78% of people said surveillance cameras were a good idea right after the Boston Marathon attack.
Mm-hmm.
Receptiveness to cameras on street corners reflects a public that regards terrorism as a fact of life in the United States.
Well, it kind of is.
Yeah. Yeah, 9 out of 10 people polled said Americans would always have to live with the risk. Well, what's happened?
What did America do?
Yeah. Let's go back to the year 2000. And there was, you remember, 1993, there was the World Trade Center attack. These were truck bombs, as I remember them, put in the basement of the World Trade
Center. They were in the parking lot.
In the first place. So there were, there were things. But what happened around then? Then 9/11 happened, and it was like a flash from the blue. What is it? That's not the phrase. What
a flashback?
No, out of the blue.
I can't help you with everything.
Okay. Out of the blue, it came. But, there was this, and by the way, sometimes there's explanations for things, but that doesn't qualify as an excuse. And no matter what the explanation was, no matter what the U.S. has done in the Middle East or what it did to Iraq prior to the invasion and all that, no matter, that the United States, according to Al-Qaeda, was occupying the Holy Land, supporting the Saudi dictator, nothing could possibly justify the carnage. But it goes both ways. Nothing can justify the carnage that the United States visits on other people as well. And so, to us, the Osama bin Ladens and the Tsarnaev brothers are the most evil people imaginable. And the fact that there are people that think of them as heroes.
Yeah. And the fact that people think that our warmongering and what we've done to.
So it's a flip.
Civilians.
On each side, it's a flip. And you could say, well, somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong. Yes and no. I mean, once this...
Depends on your point of view, right?
Once the, yeah, this murderous cycle begins, you know, where do you get off? And one of the things, as we've always said on this show, that would go a long way to not making terrorism a fact of life in the United States is to disengage. And already the criticism from some of these internationalist circles is that there's a wave of isolationism coming.
In what way?
Well, that we would not be involved everywhere in the world, fighting every battle on every continent.
So these are predictions?
Well, there's fearful that these policymakers that are involved in global trade and global military adventures want to maintain the United States to have an international presence everywhere. So we have hundreds of bases. We have, you know, commands for every continent. We have carrier groups and planes everywhere. Planes in the air.
We are everywhere.
We are everywhere. Well, it after a while, it's just not going to work. Empires always collapse. And we're stretching ourselves so thin as it is and making tremendous numbers of enemies as we go along. Let me see if there's anything. Oh, yeah. And there's been this incredible fascination. This is kind of on a tangent. And there's this fascination with the Tsarnaev brothers. You know, where they came from, Chechnya. Mm-hmm. You know, why weren't they more integrated into American society? They seem to, particularly Dzhokhar. I mean, he's like, I just killed three people and wounded 260, and I'm going to go play video games and hang out with my pals.
My gosh.
Yeah. I mean, talk about the definition of a sociopath, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's been article after article. Where were they radicalized? Were they self-radicalized?
Was it the brother? Did he bring it back? Yeah. Was it the mother?
You know, and you want to get...
angry mother.
You want to get to the root of evil. You want to find out, you know, what caused this. You know, there's a book written, Adolf Eichmann, who was the architect of the extermination of the Jews. I mean, he did all the planning and whatever. Mm-hmm. He was a bureaucrat. In fact, you know, he was just following orders. But there was a book written about him, about his, I think it was about his trial in Israel when he was finally captured, like in 1960 or something like that. And this woman, Hannah Arendt, wrote a book called The Banality of Evil. Banal, right? Just ordinary, nothing much to it. And when you get down to the core of any mass murderer, whether it's these serial killers that are,
like Dahmer.
Yeah, that are roaming the United States. What do they think? There, at any given time in the United States, there's 60 serial killers afoot, mostly killing women, mostly men.
60?
Yeah.
Are you're kidding?
Well, I mean, they're not killing 90 people or something like that, but you know, they every once in a while they kill somebody. Anyway, so
God.
Yeah. So, but when you get down to it, this Dzhokhar, he's just this college kid, and
Dartmouth.
Dartmouth, well...
Wasn't it?
Yeah, I didn't get that. Is that... It's not the Dartmouth. Isn't Dartmouth like in New Hampshire or something, a real fancy college?
Well, maybe he did go to college there. Maybe.
But it was University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. But anyway.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So...
I mean, he was... We can, university.
We can delve into it all we want. I mean, I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings when I say this, but, you know, my interest in rock and roll is, and blues and jazz and all that is pretty intense.
Yep.
My interest in the people that play it is rather limited.
The people that play it?
Yeah. The people that play rock and roll.
You mean the musicians?
Yeah, the biographies. I know the people are really fans, but they want to find, you know, there's all these.
Yeah, there's one right over here. It's heavy metal.
Yeah.
Forward by Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden. One of these types of books.
Yeah.
You wouldn't read this.
Or, you know, there's been what? Autobiographies by Keith Richard and Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
The point being, I mean, it's good. It's cool. I'm not even criticizing anybody. It just doesn't interest me. And in the same manner, it doesn't interest me, you know, the depth of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's personality. Because what if they find out he's a total twistoid? Or what if they find out that he's just an ordinary kid that was pissed off at U.S. foreign policy? Where do we learn? What do we learn? Nothing. But and what we care about are his acts. that there has to be, because this was a political act. We want to get to the root of it politically. But both to
the reason why.
Well, but we also want to
make his head.
I'm not just saying, you know, that I mean, we've got to listen. As long as we're in this position, you know, we want to do what we can to make sure that never happens again. Long range is we ought to completely adjust our foreign policy. In the short run, I want to make sure that nobody's going to be going into the venue where I am or you are or any of you listening are.
I just stay home. You know, I'm a hermit.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
You know,
I'm always out and about. As we say. But for instance, this gives you the exact example of what I was going to talk about. There was that fertilizer plant that blew up in Texas.
Yes.
And do you remember how many people that were killed? Was it 14? See, I can't even remember.
Yeah, because it's one story after another. Yeah, I can't keep them all straight.
Well, we don't know anything about the Texans who died. There was some. There was a little bit. There were all these volunteer firefighters.
There weren't the pictures. Right. On television and you know, it wasn't in People magazine.
And one of the things that happened, it's pretty clear that there was this criminality involved on the part of the plant owners, the production facility.
Lack of regulation.
And so are they, should we look into their hearts to see what caused them to make a few extra dollars that they didn't put in the proper safety
precaution? Is that
precaution?
Not evil?
Yeah. That they had so much fertilizer. They had like a thousand times more fertilizer that could be stored in one place without reporting it to Homeland Security.
Oh, my God.
It did nothing. So it's sort of what, reverberates. And, you know, we're living in a society of such enormous corruption now that at every turn we find out more and more. By the way, I got to say, it was.
And it's never ending. It's ongoing.
I mean, if you read, and I do it for this show. I mean, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. I read the New York Times every day, including the business section, which is like a crime blotter for all the people that are indicted, which I'm sure is
about collar crime.
1% of people actually doing all these scams that are caught. Yeah. Certainly in New York state politics, there's just everybody's wearing a wire, everybody's getting indicted, everybody's getting convicted. And still, say in the 1860s, 1880s, 1890s, I mean, this is like clean politics and clean business to what was going on.
Any kind of regulation.
Yeah. And when I think about these people, when I think about these people on the right that object to regulations and government interference and all that. I mean, do they really want what happened like in Bangladesh with the collapse of that building? Do they really want like that fire that happened in?
I just think they have zero grasp of reality and how it could be and how it would be if they got all of these crazy ideas passed through somehow.
Well, you know that there was just this poll came out. Almost 30% of registered voters believed armed revolution might be necessary in the next few years. You see
God,
that?
Please.
Yeah. They said to protect liberties.
People need to chill out. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of bad that goes on in the world and in this country.
Yeah, 18% of Democrats said that could be the possibility, that there could be a necessity for an armed revolution. And 44% of Republicans.
Oh, this is also very shocking to me.
Yeah. So we're talking about a political party that is based in a good part on crazy people.
And fear.
And fear.
And
yeah.
anger and ignorance. Yeah. And I could go on.
And so why in the world would these people be so fearful? I mean, part of it, we don't want to talk about this too much, but there's a black guy.
Oh,
in the White House.
Right.
That kind of freaked him out a little. But it's not only that. I mean, when they talk about what liberties are going to be taken away, it's a little difficult to get out of them exactly what they're talking about. I mean, lately, because after these horrendous shootings, these ones that go on every single day. Did you read about this? A 5-year-old boy accidentally shot his 2-year-old sister to death in rural southern Kentucky.
Yeah, terrible.
He'd gotten a rifle. He's 5 years old. He'd gotten a rifle last year as a gift. So he got a 4-year-old. The mother heard a shot and said that the rifle was kept in a corner, and the family didn't realize that a bullet was left in it. It was a .22 caliber rifle as a gift for a 4-year-old. And according
these
to
these people are so stupid.
According
I'm sorry,
to the Cumberland County coroner, he said it's a cricket. It's the name of a gun. It's a company that specifically makes guns, clothes, and books for children. It's a little rifle for a kid, he said. The little boy is used to shooting the little gun.
Aww.
Now, the company is based in Milton, Pennsylvania. It's called Keystone Sporting Arms.
They should be ashamed of themselves.
Produced 60,000 cricket and chipmunk rifles.
Oh, my God.
Last year, according to its website. It also makes guns for adults, but most of its products are geared towards children.
Huh.
The smaller guns come in all sorts of colors, including blue and pink.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
Yeah, the company's...
Any parent who buys these for their kids is irresponsible and insane.
Yeah, I guess. The company's slogan is, "My First Rifle."
Oh, God!
And its website has a kids' corner section where pictures of young boys and girls are displayed, most of them showing children at the shooting range and on bird and deer hunts.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah.
What happened to little plastic toy rifles.
That's so fun. You can't kill anything.
Yeah, you know, even if I had kids, I wouldn't even let
them
use
those.
But
that's not the fear. The fear are these absolutely vile people at the National Rifle Association that are doing everything they can to instill fear in gun owners. I mean, there's 76 million.
And it's working.
Yeah, there's 76 million gun owners. These folks got about 5 million of them. And they have politicians scared to death that they can't even get in the slightest alteration on how we keep track of what maniac is going to wind up with some
background checks,
lethal
like that.
Battleground weapon.
Were you going to read about Wayne LaPierre? The head of the NRA said, well, the headline is LaPierre, NRA members will never surrender guns. Well, duh. We know that. No one's asking him to.
See, this is what I mean. This is why, you know, people are manipulated. If it's you, I'm talking to you. You're manipulated by this guy.
Yeah.
So he can keep his $1 million salary. And who's the big supporter of the NRA? Everybody knows that by now. Don't they? The big rifle companies.
You know? No question.
The big armament manufacturers. He said that recent gun control efforts in Congress will, quote, destroy us and every ounce of freedom. Now,
this guy needs to chill out and quit the hype.
Now, LaPierre, I've seen videos of him in the 90s calling for universal background checks. The NRA.
So he's gone batty.
Yeah, he's gone batty. Well,
due to money.
Sees where the money is. Now, LaPierre directed much of his criticism at President Barack Obama and his efforts to pass legislation in Congress that would have expanded background checks for gun sales. Now, 80% of people, including gun owners, including Republicans, want background checks for everybody. Now, this just said expanded. It's not like there weren't any.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're going to say, okay, we're registering everybody.
Right.
They're trying to...
register.
They're trying to... find a point where they can at least stop a little of what's going on.
I mean, hell, even when I got my Glock, Peter, they gave me a background check.
LaPierre said the bill wouldn't have prevented Newtown or Aurora. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. You don't know. But it won't prevent the next tragedy, and it might not. But what else? What are we going to do? Get more mental health legislation. Well, yeah, we should do that.
Yeah.
I mean, the one sensible thing they say.
How about legislation so people who are mentally ill have a place to go?
Yeah, but here is what's going on. If background checks as they are, when you go into a gun shop to buy a weapon, you get a background check. So are they saying, I don't get what these guys are all about. Are they saying there shouldn't be any at all? No, you know what? They would say they don't want to expand them. So it's all right to do a background check if a person goes into Joe's, gun and ammo and liquor and ammunition store.
And porn.
And
some porn.
Yeah, yeah. And then you get background checks. So they're not objecting to that. The NRA is not saying we got to repeal all background check legislation. They're saying that expanding it to do gun shows and private sales among strangers will destroy us and every ounce of our freedom. I mean,
meanwhile, it makes perfect sense.
If you believe that, I just don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
so what do you believe? 313-298-9743.
Okay. Got a little more, but maybe this would be an apt time to take a break. I want to go back a little more just on the corruption and the effect that it has on us. And why government control? When you have capitalism, you have to have strong government regulations.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click bam boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click bam boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
Hey, babe. I know you're the chameleon with the great eye, so I wanted to talk about the color we painted the living room.
Oh, that new Cosmic Berry? It's great.
Yeah, it's good. But Valspar has the Love Your Color guarantee, so if we don't love it, we get another color free.
We do love it, so no need to change.
Are we certain we love it?
We love it. We didn't love having your mother stay with us for a month.
We didn't have a choice.
We are chameleons. We always have a choice.
Offer ends 10/7/13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
Okay, everybody, so Jim is going to take us all through the company's plans for marketing, sales, and manufacturing for the next 5 years across every facet of our global business. Then, we'll break for lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings. Jim?
Okay.
Growth. Ha! Great presentation, Jim. Thank you. Lunch, everybody?
Lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings. Amazing burgers, deliciously hot wings, and great sports. That's a lunch you can't wait to get to.
Who wants more wings?
Oh, yeah!
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff.
Somebody, someone like you.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, so these crazy Republicans, 44% of them think that there's going to have to be an armed revolution in order to protect our liberties within the next few years. And you know what? I hope they launch something.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because we'll be rid of them. They will be gone. You know, I just think it's a lot of mouthing because...
Yeah, sure.
Because what are they going to do? I mean, as long as the political state, the United States, remains intact and a bunch of these guys come out of the woods with their semi-automatics, they're going to say... All right, bring in the helicopters, you know, the gunships. Gone. But, you know, what I'm concerned about is this mentality that this is what we see is happening now in Iraq, for instance, this war's footing with everyone. And it's understandable. I mean, they just went through a war, one that killed all these people unnecessarily because of Bush's lies. But what we need are people that are envisioning peace and how to bring it about. And it doesn't mean that you got to, you know, lay down for anybody or not protect yourself or what have you. But
it doesn't make you weak.
We have to have strategies for peace or we are going to be like this all the time. And probably, given the odds, that most of us will never die in a bombing or, you know, in a hijacked plane or that driven into a building or be in the building that gets driven into. But something like that can continue to happen. By the way, there are about 1,000 right-wing militias in this country. Armed and
really?
Yeah, I just was reading this. You know how many left-wing militias there are? Zero.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, get this. So everybody knows these are really and very frequently proto-fascist.
I know, Tea Partiers are a little bit.
Yeah, proto-fascist to politics. And every once in a while they get busted and they're arming to the teeth to take on the federal government. What would you think if try it? Well, don't try it, actually. In fact, don't try it. People put together a left-wing militia. Or a militia of young anarchists, right? How long do you think they would last? I mean, these right-wing militias, they train out in the open. They have big meetings. They have barbecues.
I don't think the left-wing one, they would be too unorganized.
Not some of these socialists and communists. Maybe the anarchists.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Or how about this? How about an African-American militia?
Oh, gosh.
How long do you think that would last?
Not long.
Not long, right. So it's okay for these, and that's what always happened in Europe as well. I mean, these fascist movements would organize these extra-legal militias. It was like the brown shirts in Germany and the black shirts in Italy and the Falange in Spain. And everybody said, well, God, you know, that's kind of a bummer that these guys are doing it. But then, you know, they were in a position to actually not to protect their liberties, but to overthrow the government, democratic governments, and install fascist regimes. And we know how that wound up. All right, here is Brian in Monroe. Brian, you're there in the home of Fermi II and General Custer.
I live in Tecumseh. I'm on my way home from Monroe.
Well, drive fast. You never can tell.
No, I'm driving slow because I know the cops around here.
All right, we'll drive slow. What was I saying? Drive fast. Drive slow. You're right.
But at any rate, but no, I agree with you absolutely 100%. There's nothing wrong with guns, but as far as you need to restrict who can buy them.
Yeah, well, how do you do that? You mean like people buy background checks?
Background checks is about all you can do. I am a multiple gun owner. I'm a sports shooter. I am a hunter, you know, and all of my buddies are NRA this, NRA that. I do not agree with the NRA. 100%, I do not agree with the NRA.
Well, you know, Brian, we get very few phone calls like this.
But you know,
you're
Brian,
a rarity, Brian.
There's a lot of NRA members that don't agree. With the leadership.
I do love my guns. Don't get me wrong. But it's like, you know, I don't want complete and total freedom of people buying guns.
Now, you know, the NRA, which was set up as a shooters and hunters organization, which is then a great organization for people like you, Brian, and it has transformed itself into an hysterical right-wing political organization.
Big business.
And big, yeah, you know, big business, yeah. Like that.
And, you know, for the most part, I'm a blue-collar guy, so I'm not going to vote Republican.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a smart man, too.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't know why there can't be a Democrat that says, okay, let me support the people that are responsible.
Well, don't you think that's what's happening with the, you know, there's not even an assault weapons ban. All of this is talking about is getting everybody under the same umbrella that applies to what when one goes to, you know, Kmart or your local gun shop, right?
The thing I'm saying is there is nothing in between. You know, there's no working technically as far as political standpoint.
Yeah.
There's nothing in between. If you're a gun owner, as far as Democrats go, you are what you are. You know, you shouldn't be doing that.
I guess, but
guns are bad in their standpoint for the most part. I can't say not all of them view it that way, but.
Well, you know, a minority of the people and a decreasing number of people own guns and a decreasing number of people hunt. I mean, not that that means that people shouldn't. I mean, I play a sport where hardly that anybody plays. I mentioned from time to time handball, you know. I mean, I
didn't even know what it was.
Yeah. But so, I mean, that's okay. But I think that most people, and particularly younger people increasingly, don't want guns around. So what's happening is the gun owners are buying more and more and more guns. I mean, so that there's more guns in the hands of a few people, which, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why anybody. I mean, some people want them. They like to have them around. I saw somebody with like 20 of them in their bedroom on racks.
What?
I saw a photograph.
I understand that. I mean, it's a hobby. I understand that, but you got to be sane to do it.
Absolutely. And I certainly wasn't trying to paint you as anything other than exactly how you defined yourself. And in fact, I'm not even as much concerned. I am some concerned with the prevalence of guns, obviously in the wrong hands. But what I'm most concerned about is how this transformation of this machine that brings people a lot of joy through shooting, target shooting, and hunting, and sometimes somewhere, you know, men go out with their sons, now with their daughters, and all that, and how this has suddenly become an arena of, like, for a small group of people, but ones that are very loud about it, into this absolute paranoia where half the Republican Party almost thinks we're going to have an armed revolution in the next few years.
I agree with you 100%.
I mean, that is just bonkers beyond belief.
People need to just calm down.
All right, Brian, thank you very much. I appreciate your call.
Brian, you're sane.
Yeah.
Very sane.
I think here is Paul in Southfield. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
Good evening. Actually, for not morning yet. I think this is the thing, too, that a lot of these Republicans, a lot of these conservatives, it's really almost like a form of mail. It's like, you know, the paranoia of everyone's going to come and get their guns and that thing. And I read, I think it was last winter, I read it, and I was in the library, I read in the Progressive, I think it's Progressive or Mother Jones magazine.
Mm-hmm. As you said, these are magazines for me.
They did a study that how we are in our politics and what we think is the pathology. You're going to be, usually if you're conservative, I'm just going to upset a lot of people here. If you're conservative, you're basically self-centered. And that's a form of, you know, it's a me versus we type of thinking.
Yeah.
Where liberals are very much more into the we. We're all in it together. Well, that's a form of mental maturity where people are self-centered. It's a form of mental immaturity. Do you know where I'm coming from?
Well, I absolutely
do. I tend to agree.
In fact, I was looking here. This is interesting, Paul, because I had something like that exactly written down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is
fascinating. Read.
I can't remember his first name. There's a psychologist named Maslow, M-A-S-L-O-W. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his first name right now. But here, I'm looking at this editorial from the New York Times from April 28th, and it's talking about how federal banking regulators are clamping down on small but growing number of banks that imitate the predatory practices of these storefront payday lenders. And what they do, poor people, you know, for one thing, they might not even have a bank account. So
and those places are everywhere.
Yeah. And so, So they the industry business model relies on the fact that most people cannot afford to pay the original loan. So they usually get 2 weeks to repay it. So they don't, but the lenders know this. They know that they're not going to be able to do it. They wind up saddled with long-term debts carrying interest rates of 400% or more.
Mm-hmm. So, and that would be illegal if we had, you know, a good government where, you know, progressive type of government, but that sure wouldn't be allowed. It would be, you know.
But 15 states had. In fact, here's the I like this language. After watching millions of consumers being eaten alive by transactions, 15 states have banned these predatory loans. But now these banks are getting into it as well. So here is the rich preying upon the poor. Now, and here, I want to go back, Paul, to what you said.
Same old story, Peter.
And this is what I wrote down. The capitalists have these individualist spirit. In other words, it's dog eat dog. And if I can eat, or what did it say? Yeah, it said eaten alive. If I can eat these poor people, too bad. And
well, the Ayn Rand mentality, you know.
Absolutely.
Where
liberals, liberals, leftists, progressives have a collective spirit. And you know, this is how it manifests itself. Like, like today in my neighborhood, about 15 neighbors got together and did a cleanup. And it's the kind of thing when something goes wrong in the neighborhood, suddenly everybody's out there trying to help. And that's the kind of motivating spirit, or somebody is sick in the neighborhood and doesn't.
Exactly.
You know, it can't buy a hospital like these rich guys can. So you have a fundraiser at a bowling alley or something like
and
that.
And lobbying for capitalism has never worked ever.
Because of the rapacious nature of the people that rise to the top in capitalism, they have to be tightly, tightly, tightly controlled, or we know what they'll do. They'll work 8-year-olds in factories. They'll work people 16 hours a day. They'll call out the cops and goons and National Guard and shoot people down if they say, I want a dime an hour more. These are people people say, I'm a capitalist, and I say, oh, what do you own? They go, huh? I mean, I'm talking about owners, and I'm talking about the big owners. And these are the big owners, remember, that have destroyed our economy in the short run. But in the longer run, these are the men, particularly, probably a few women in there, but for the most part, we can say the men, who decided, I couldn't care less about Detroit or Akron or Sacramento or anything like that. I want to go overseas and get the cheapest labor I can. You know, because I was making enough money before. It wasn't like the labor costs were killing me.
But I want more.
But I want more. I want to provide more return on my investment. So these, excuse my language, it's a little before 12. I'll risk my job. These son of a bitches. because that's what they are. These are horrible human beings that are portrayed as the generators of wealth and what have you. They do it on the backs of people. They destroy whole nations. They enslave people in one nation, and when finally, after decades and hundreds of years almost of struggle for the individual worker to have a decent life, they just pull the rug out from everybody and say, hey, we're going to go over to Bangladesh. We're going to go over to Vietnam. We're going to go over to China and screw up those countries and poison the atmosphere and the water and everything else there. Well,
and not care about the people there and those water supplies that they're destroying over there.
Yeah. All right, Paul. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody think we're being too hard on the individual entrepreneur? And I'm not talking about, you know, necessarily some...
I'm talking like about like my dad, who was a car dealer. We're not talking about him.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to ask his workers.
He was the best. We just had this conversation the other night. My dad was the best boss to his workers.
Really. I know lots of people that own small businesses.
Oh, yeah.
And they're decent.
He owned these car dealerships for 35, 40 years. And guess what? There are people, he sold them all, but there are people who still work there, who started there from the beginning. They worked for him forever, Peter. That's how you know.
And when you see what's happening in Asia now, like this, building, the Sohel Rana, this building that collapsed in, Savar, Bangladesh, killing almost, 500 people, and the fact that the workers were working for as little as $40 a month making clothes for JCPenney and downstairs and all of that. This replicates exactly what happened in this country.
To manufacturing.
Yeah, to manufacturing and just, when, you know, capitalist wage work, replaced, the kind of community-based and artisan-based production, which was a long time ago. I mean, in order to have mass production, the idea was that you had to do what you had to do. But, I mean, what happened in the 19th century and into the 20th century, what happened to human people's lives, to families, to communities, to the environment, is just horrible. So, and remember that the conservatives who only act in the interest of the 1%, you know, and they mouth all this stuff about the Constitution and liberty and all that, as we say every week, didn't want a minimum wage, didn't want people to unionize.
Didn't want women to vote.
Didn't want women to vote. Well, we're going way back for that. But I'm talking about particularly an economic thing. Opposed opposed the Clean Water Act, even though, you know, I know Nixon signed it, but it was, you know, put in by the Republicans were opposed to it.
Not everyone is evil 100% to the core. Wait, George Bush. George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Hey, did you see? Did we talk about that? Barbara Bush made a sane statement.
Oh, yeah.
That there's been enough Bushes.
Yeah.
We agree.
The owner, let's see where his name is here. Oh, that was his name, Sohel Rana. Right. I'm sorry.
In Bangladesh.
Yeah, in Bangladesh. But he's the most...
A lot of people probably don't even know what happened over there.
Yeah, there was this building collapsed a week ago or so. The owner was told, look, this building's going to collapse. And he's not. And he ordered all the workers back in. It collapsed. Hundreds and hundreds of people dead. Said, and people are, you know, he's the most hated man in Bangladesh. People are calling for his execution. And Mr. Rana has been vilified. He is partly a creation of the garment era in Bangladesh, during which global businesses have arrived. Gee, where from? I wonder. In search. All right. And here it all is. I mean, we look at the Tsarnaev brothers as like these arch villains. They are. They are. Without a doubt, no explanation eliminates their deed. You know, that people that had nothing to do with what they complain about. But here too, isn't this man a criminal of the same order? But before his building collapsed, he was this well-respected
business guy.
Business guy.
You know, almost 400 people died.
You know, this is an old. If you're looking at this, the most hated Bangladeshi.
Yeah.
It's up towards 500.
Is it really?
Like that. You know, it's like the guns. They always say, this is going to hurt law-abiding citizens. Yeah, they're a law-abiding citizen before they go back to the office where they are fired from and act out. Same thing here. Said he's been vilified. He's partly a creation of the garment industry. The global businesses have arrived in search of cheap labor to keep profits high and costs low. In other words, they couldn't care less about anyone other than themselves.
Right. The working conditions, the people who are making those products for them. Get it done, get out. Here's your 5 cents a minute, or 5 cents a day.
You know this new HBO show, Vice, that's produced by Bill Maher?
No.
They go all around the world. There was in India, in Mumbai, there is this guy, this billionaire that's building this home that is really a skyscraper. You know, it's like, and because he was, one of his rivals had like a, something like a six-story building.
So he had to make it
a 12-story building. This was his home. And then, but their contrast.
He probably has a really small.
They're contrasting. The commentator on Vice was contrasting the way the, all these people in Mumbai, India, lived. And they're just showing, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people in Mumbai, which has like 20 million people in it, live in garbage dumps.
Oh, my God.
And they also, by gleaning, by trying to find, cell phones that have been discarded and computers.
And food.
And food, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
This goes on all over South America.
So this is why I'm talking about regulations. So these companies, these wonderful entrepreneurs, American companies, went in search of cheap labor. In other words, they don't want to pay you a decent wage, a living wage, a middle class wage. They don't want you to have a house in the suburbs or a boat or a motorcycle or maybe a cottage because the company was making so goddamn much money that they could afford to pay you that because they figured out, wait a minute. If I go over to Bangladesh, I could make all that much more money. And your house goes into foreclosure. Yeah. You have to sell your bike and your cottage and what have
and
you.
And without a care. They just don't even care at all, Peter.
Yeah. So where's the evil there? Is this just more the banality of evil? Who's more evil? Sohail Rana, who kills hundreds and hundreds and hundreds? Or Zokhar Tsarnaev? Or you know what? Maybe they're not even in a race. Maybe they're equal. But we ought to see that as clearly that they're both mass murderers, for sure.
Yes, they are.
Excuse me. I wasn't choking up. I was just
choking.
Well, I should. We should choke up. We should be in tears.
Yeah.
I mean, the slaughter that's going on.
And the slaughter that goes on every day that's not even really reported widely. You know, I remember when I went to Europe, Peter, it was the news, when you see the news over there, it's just so much more, to me, well, it's more world news, but it seems more real to me than over here, less sensationalized than it is here.
You know, another thing, there was something called the progressive era in the first part of the 20th century where all of this legislation at that time, similar to the 60s and the 70s, was pushed through to protect the people, like the Antitrust Act, because, you know, these huge the conglomerates like Standard Oil were just driving everybody out of business. So they had like the Meats Act, the Meats Inspection Act, the some pure food and drug acts to stop the adulteration of the food, the poisoning of Americans by these American companies that were like Swift and Armour, for instance, in meats.
Yeah.
And all you got to do is, what's that book by Upton Sinclair?
The Jungle.
The Jungle, yeah.
Read that. You won't eat meat for, if ever, a really long time.
And every conservative, of course, opposed that. So we were interfering with the market. We were interfering with the right.
Because someone wanted to tell the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now in China, did you see that? They caught a gang of traders in eastern China who bought rat, fox, and mink flesh and sold it as mutton, sheep, right? But that and other cases of meat smuggling, faking, and adulteration featured in Chinese newspapers and websites were unlikely to instill confidence in consumers already queasy over many reports about meat, fruit, and vegetables laden with disease, toxin, banned dyes, and preservatives.
Food is a huge, huge issue right now.
Yeah, and
we should be worried about it. I told you earlier that when we had our little impromptu meeting, we don't talk about GMOs enough on this show. This is all part of that.
Genetic modified organisms. They would do better with that stuff than this. One typical baffled and angry user said, how many rats does it take to put together a sheep?
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, it depends on what part of the, you know, of the animal you're using.
Okay. But
I know.
Because you slaughtered them.
Not alive.
No.
But I've done some butchering.
You've done some butchering.
Yeah.
This is in chef school, folks.
Yeah.
But the point being is that if you're going to have capitalism, it has to have rigid regulations, absolutely rigid regulations, or you get this. So what's going to happen? All these people are going to be eating this crap, getting sick, dying. The whole country of China is befouled, just like the United States was before we at least cleaned up a little. But we're still polluting in this country that we allow these corporations, rather than forcing them to put in pollution controls,
I go to China, I'm eating vegetarian.
There you go.
I have to say, I can butcher an animal, but I'm not even going to.
All right, we got a story when we come back. Bags of cash.
Really?
Millions
Did you
of
find some?
Millions of dollars of
share?
Bags of cash. And you know who it belongs to? You and me. And, you know, it ain't going to us.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Anything on two wheels, then I've got everything you need to know. The Riff Hog Report, brought to you by Jerry Aaron, the motorcycle lawyer who rides at 1-800-MI-BIKER. See more at WRIF.com/Hog Report.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Save the day. Saturday, June 15th, Wolverine Harley Davidson's Harley Fest 2013 returns to Freedom Hill with 101 The Riff.
Oh, I hit the Riff!
You're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIN.
All right, thank you very much. This is our second hour. If you'd like to participate, 313-298-WRIF. I think that capitalism itself is a predatory, anti-human economic system. Many of us have benefited, or actually statistically, probably fairly few of us, if you think about the entire world. But it can be made tolerable with enough regulations, and it's got to be really, really tightly controlled. Are these people, you know, they'll work us to death as they did. I mean, if you're thinking, wow, man, what are you talking about? I got a nice home in the suburbs, and I work 40 hours, and everything's okay. Well, good.
Good for you.
Good for you.
But think about the percentage of people who are not okay.
Yeah. And then you think, well, you know, I got strong unions still, even though unions are really going down the drain.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're looking over and they can't outsource, for instance, they can't outsource my job. Well, maybe not. You know, they're actually talking now about bringing some of these garment industry jobs back because they're getting these big firms like JCPenney and Gap and all that are getting such a bad rap, deservedly, because
yes.
of what's happening to their suppliers
sure.
in other countries.
Well, I sure hope that happens.
Yeah, but they're gonna say, well, you know, the garment workers union. I don't think so. How about $7.75 an
Just
hour?
Just garment workers, right?
Yeah, $7.75 an hour. Benefits? We can't afford that. We'll keep it in Bangladesh. You know, if you want that. I mean, what do you want? Do you want $7.75, or should we keep producing in Bangladesh? Yeah. All right. So we're talking about when you don't have these regulations. These really smart guys figure out that you can sell rat meat as lamb in China. Same thing, same kind of stuff.
That is so gross.
Another thing that's happened after this financial meltdown caused by a not sufficiently regulated economic system, something was put into place called Barney Frank was one of them, the Frank Bill. Oh, the Dodd-Frank Bill, right.
Sure.
The Dodd-Frank law that would regulate, to some extent, revamp financial regulations in the United States. Really didn't do much. But Wall Street bankers and some of the world's top finance ministers, this is from the New York Times, are waging a bitter international campaign to block Washington financial regulators from extending their policing powers far beyond the nation's shores. Now, get this. The effort, centered on the oversight of the $700 trillion marketplace of the financial instruments known as derivatives, and all of you know what derivatives are, right? But get the figure. These are people playing with $700 trillion. That's enough money to solve every problem in the world, yet these guys are manipulating it in order to enrich themselves and the few, you know, the 1%. So, I mean, we can always say, well, okay, it's their money, and just let it go at that. Or we can let, you know, kids in this country go without proper nutrition or schools or what have you. Crime will rise because of poverty and what have you. We have a country as it is, richest country in the world, where some of that $700 trillion circulates. And we have probably half the population that is either near poor or poor. So, I mean, you could do it. By the way, these controls are very weak to begin with. And all they're trying to do is rein in these hedge funds and foreign institutions. Let me see here. What does this say? One form of derivatives, credit default swaps, help. And you know, everybody knows what credit default swaps are, right? Right? Yeah, help topple the giant insurer American International Group in 2008. So that's why it's just a crap game, you know, that these people are playing with these enormous sums of money that translate only into personal wealth for the selfish of the planet. And there's, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10,000 men, few women, very few, not even numbers so small, not even worth including them, 10,000 men or so, that control the vast wealth of the planet. And they're not using it. Some of them do. You can say, oh, look at Bill Gates. Look at all the charity he does. There shouldn't have to be charity.
One guy. You know,
there shouldn't have to be charity. Thank you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, sir. And I'm not, and maybe that's not even nice to do, because there are some of you listening that are in such dire straits that you're put into that position. And you shouldn't be. There's enough wealth here. There's enough that has to be done in real terms, not trading ciphers on a screen that aren't even done by human beings anymore. They're done by computer trades and all of that. That means that you shouldn't have your house foreclosed on, that you don't have to work for this pittance. And everything that you shouldn't have to do as an American citizen, no one should have to do around the world. There's enough wealth in the world for everyone to live in a manner that is, for one thing, kind to the planet, but kind to us as well. And we're not being kind to billions, I didn't misspeak myself, to billions and billions of people that live a life of travail. I mean, again, I live a pretty nice life. And in that manner, I think it's only ethical that I try to extend what I experience to others as well.
When you say nice, you live a pretty simple life. People may misinterpret that you live in a big house.
I don't live in big hills,
and you have a lot of nice clothes, things like that. You are the same. You're a very simple guy.
Yeah. Describe this shirt to him. This is my favorite.
The button up shirt.
Yeah.
I think I've been on the air with you for 15 years, yeah. I think, and I think you've had that shirt the whole time.
Yeah.
But your wife does a heck of a good laundry job. She kept that shirt nice.
Well, it's pretty frayed, isn't it?
No.
Look at that.
But you don't care.
Yeah, I don't care.
An Earth First t-shirt.
Right. And Levi's with a hole in the knee.
Standard fare.
Yeah, right.
Did you see my pants? I have more holes in mine.
But you've got like cool jeans. I did this the honest way by doing work out in the garage.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I did too.
You did. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right, let's go onward here. Here's Michael and Fenton. Michael, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Yeah, I hope them holes in your shirt are in the right places, Julie.
For decency sense.
Yeah.
Peter doesn't pay attention to any of that kind of stuff anyway.
Yeah, heck no, I heard about you, Julie, and you're hot.
Down boy.
I'm what?
You're hot.
Oh, I thought he was going to say ornery or naughty or, well, I'm flattered. I'm flattered. Thank you.
And we can say, I should have said this at the top of the hour. Anyway, you can go to our Facebook page and you can make that decision for yourself.
Yeah, because you know what? Not everyone is everyone's type, right?
Yeah. Facebook.com/nightcall. There's a couple of photographs that Jalene has put on there where I look like a dork, but she couldn't care less because she looks so good.
That's not true. That's not what I did.
There's at least one.
Okay, there's one.
Yeah.
I'll admit to it.
There's one.
I had to prove that we were at a certain rally, you know.
There was others. Anyway,
why don't we take a picture where you look really great and I'll just jack my hair all up and look horrible.
We'll have a podcast available, by the way, in about 12 hours. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, or the WRIF.com website as well. Michael, go ahead, sir.
Yes.
Yes. I was a couple things, Peter. I heard that, brothers that bombed the Boston Marathon there, that they did that with government phones. And I was wondering if you knew
government
anything
what?
About
phones.
Peter, I was wondering if you knew anything about the Homeland Security was talking about they're going to buy another $1.6 billion rounds of ammo. What's going on with that?
Well, the thing about government phones is this kind of right-wing deal where they claim that Obama is giving poor people phones. Have you heard this, Jalene?
I have heard this, and it totally makes me mad.
This is, you know, one of the things when you hear these kind of things, Michael, what you got to do is go to Snopes, Snopes.com, and check out its veracity, whether it's true or not. And these programs are actually put together by the phone companies. And not, you know, and they go back into the Reagan, some of them, you know, before like landlines go back into the Reagan era, even where they began. I don't know why the government is buying this up. This is, you know, more right-wing conspiracy that the Homeland Security is trying to do it because they're trying to deny, you know, the citizenry, the weaponry they need to defend themselves against tyranny. All right, Michael, thank you very much. That's my answer to that. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. I want to do one. Where was this? I never even talked about that. While more U.S. servicemen are dying in Afghanistan in a war that nobody can understand, I wonder, you know, we haven't heard from any Afghan war vets recently, but whenever... Remember John Kerry, who was the Secretary of State, who was a decorated Vietnam war hero. He said something about who was going to be the last man to die in Vietnam. Okay. And it must be, and war, you know, with the American troops leaving Afghanistan, that must be going through the minds of the people there and those of you who were there and still have friends and comrades in the field probably are thinking that as well. So, and I saw both the figure seven and eight American soldiers died this weekend, yeah. Both in direct attacks. It's the Taliban is pledging an even more aggressive campaign against the what would they call it? Well, it is the invading and occupying troops. But another aspect of it is, and you get this, for more than a decade, this is from the New York Times again, wads of American dollars packed into suitcases, backpacks, and on occasion plastic shopping bags have been dropped off every month or so at the offices of Afghanistan's president, courtesy of
the CIA,
the Central Intelligence Agency. Except, you know, I would... you know,
what's with the backpacks and the plastic bags?
I don't know. This may be just what they had available.
Very weird.
You know, but I also edit a magazine. I do editing for people. And I would have changed that courtesy of the American taxpayer.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All told, tens of millions of dollars have flowed from the CIA, and again, you know, through you and I, to the office of President Hamid Karzai, according to current and former advisors to the Afghan leader. Khalil Rahman, who served as Mr. Karzai's deputy chief of staff, says, "We called it ghost money. It came in secret and it left in secret." The CIA has long known to support some relatives and close aides of Mr. Karzai, and again, I would put with taxpayer money. But the new accounts of the off-the-books cash delivered directly to his office show payments on a vaster scale and with a far greater impact on everyday governing. Now, these CIA agents, again, they're always supposed to be, you know, these bright guys that fix everything. They wreck everything. They go into one country after another and wind up with thousands of, if the country's lucky, thousands, if they're not, millions. Because, you know, they go back to Vietnam. And this is going to be easily done about these barefoot insurgents and what have you. And decades later, we look back and there's 3 million people dead on both sides.
That's right. But, you know, back on those Obama phones, I was out of the studio for a second, so I didn't get to get in on that conversation. But I've noticed a few Republicans, kind of people that I know on Facebook, who've said, if I could have an Obama phone and blah, blah, you know, and very negative about it. And it's like, I just want to say, you're so ignorant about that. And I really believe that there's racism involved in that. Oh. And that Obama's trying to take care of his people, you know, so they can have phones.
That's
so offensive to me.
They found this very poor, very overweight African-American woman, which I saw this video that circulates on the right, and she's yelling, "I got this phone from Obama. Obama gave me this phone." You know, so this then represents everybody. And, you know, they're taking from us and giving to them.
Obama's
which
people.
Is totally BS.
Racist SOBs.
Yeah. So anyway, so here is our, and so they're upset about that. This will never make it into the, you know, right wing sites, and when if it does, they go, oh yeah, well, you know, I don't want her to have an Obama phone. Whereas here, there's tens of millions of dollars of our tax money is given away to the CIA to this thoroughly, absolutely corrupt regime.
Yeah, and that's okay, but people don't know about it. That's the problem. People are uninformed.
And here's the CIA is so bad. These people are so dunces. There's little evidence that the payments bought the influence the CIA sought. Instead, some American officials said the cash has fueled corruption, empowered warlords, and undermined Washington's exit strategy.
And you know what? I think dunces was the wrong choice of word.
Yeah.
Because they know exactly what they're doing.
Well, you
are
know
they
what?
Dunces not, for doing it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think they've got these strategies that just don't happen. One American official said the biggest source of corruption in Afghanistan was the United States.
I couldn't agree more.
And the United States was not alone in delivering cash to the corrupt president. Iran regularly gave bags of cash to one of his top aides. But American officials jumped on the payments as evidence, now get this, of an aggressive Iranian campaign to buy influence and poison Afghanistan's relations with the United States. Aren't we a little far from home?
Yes.
Like 8,000 miles away, and aren't we trying to poison Afghanistan's relationships with Iran? Now, why is Iran meddling in the affairs of that country so far? Oh, no, no.
Oh, wait, they're right
bordered.
Kind of next door to each other.
Yeah,
that little thing. Like Canada and the U.S.,
What did what they did not say was that the CIA was also plying the presidential palace with cash, and unlike the Iranians who stopped it, they're still giving away our money. Like the Iranian cash, much of the CIA's money goes to paying off warlords and politicians. This is money that is being brought in suitcases and plastic bags, our tax money by the CIA to this corrupt president of Afghanistan, many of whom have ties to the drug trade and, in some cases, the Taliban. The result, American and Afghan officials say, is that the agency has greased the wheels of the same patronage networks that American diplomats and law enforcement agents have struggled unsuccessfully to dismantle, leaving the government in the grips of what are basically organized crime syndicates.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, George Bush.
Thank you, George Bush. Very little.
I just don't even know what to say.
I loathe you.
Let's get some more calls on the line. Thanks for your patience, folks. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dan. Dan's in Warren. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hang on. I'm turning it off. I hear exactly what you're saying. You might want to take us off air to the sources and information I have to share with you.
Sure.
It's, you have FCC license, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Peter.
Honor is going to, or they're going to black out through.
Okay.
I was ex-military of Vietnam. I know the truth about Vietnam. The war was fought over the opium trade. That's straight out fact.
Well, there's part of that. That was it, too.
There's a little bit of that in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there's a bit of that going in Afghanistan as well.
Well, property and poppy fields in Afghanistan, the bushes. Check it out.
Okay.
And if you want to know the truth of what they're doing to the Americans for the last decades, go on the website, nccs.net. In order of the constitutional pamphlets. It's true. I researched it word for word, capital letter, everything is perfect. It's by the Mormons, but they're trying to bring, and if you read this and you take, go to the library, bring up your Constitution, Bill of Rights, our great forefathers had all this information out there on paper.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dan, at about...
I actually went to Philly and saw those.
Yeah, I'm going to have a show. I'm going to have, at the end of this, either at 1 or 1:30, I'm going to be interviewing a guy about the Constitution. And as I begin saying, it's just, I always apologize. You know, this sounds kind of boring, but this guy is pretty interesting, so why don't you listen
to him? I wish I could break you of that habit.
Yeah.
I really do.
That's not good radio. You're right. But, thanks for the tip on those links. I appreciate it. Here's John in Belleville. John, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Basically, I just wanted to ask two economic questions. I always thought they were pretty interesting. One being, what were your thoughts on democratizing corporations like Walmart or McDonald's? And then how do you feel about Because basically when states become too regulatory or they raise wages to help working people, these corporations just pick up leave. It's called globalization, and you create this race to the race to the bottom. And so, like, how do you solve that? Because there's just kind of like this fluid situation where these corporations are just picking up and going where there's the least amount of pressure.
Well, it's sort of capitalist blackmail, isn't it? If we won't work for $40 a month, they're going to go where they can pay that, right?
Yeah, so it's – but I've always thought of it – because I'm a big pro-labor guy, but I've always wondered, like, how do you create a global – regulatory framework like that, because the institutions now, like the World Bank and World Trade Organization, definitely have an ideology that favors big business and corporations and that doctrine of private property. But so it's like, I don't know how. I mean, working people.
Well, here, let me make a suggestion. One of I've said this before. For some reason or other, I'd love to repeat it. When the first supplier shop in the Detroit area, the big three, decided they were going to escape from union wages and go to Georgia or Alabama, Walter Reuther should have said, the head of the UAW at the time, should have said, we are going to call a general strike in auto if you move one union job out of Michigan or out of California or wherever they were. There also should be, contrary to what these globalists want, there should be high tariffs to the point where if you go to Bangladesh, you're JCPenney, and you're going to pay somebody $40 a month to make your little pants or skirts or something like that, there should be tariffs so high that it becomes uneconomical for people to manufacture over there. And I go, oh, it would be a trade war. Well, you know, we a big enough country that we could easily be self-sufficient if it came down to it. But now we've signed on to all these rules, like the World Trade Organization. If you even hinted at that, we would be probably in violation of it. So, I mean, it could be that we're just going to have to repeat worldwide what went on from the 1840s to the 1940s, 100 years where there was this massive class struggle that, in that whole period that working people were just screwed beyond belief. And as I said, there were no regulations whatsoever. The other thing the government could have said, if you're going to exit this country, you're going to have to pay, you know, X amount of your profits for, you know, how many years after if you're located here in the United States, which would have made it, again, uneconomical for them to leave. But they thought, hey, globalization, what a great idea. But, you know, the toothpaste, what I guess I'm saying is the toothpaste is out of the tube. And so now there's the kind of things that you saw during the 1930s for unionization and the kind of struggles for environmental sanity, which we don't have. It's another thing I'm going to be talking about with one of our interviews is fracking, this idea of blowing all this water and chemicals into the earth.
And we say no fracking way.
No fracking way. Right. All right. Did we lost him? Did he hang up or did you hang up on him?
It was, yeah. It's technical.
Okay. Sorry. I missed who that was. Call back.
We apologize.
Yeah. Right. Here's something actually good news today. Good and bad. The Food and Drug Administration on Tuesday said it would make the most widely known morning after pill available without prescriptions to girls and women 15 years and older.
This really surprised me.
Yeah.
In this country.
And also make the pill available on drugstore shelves. And before they kept it locked up behind pharmacy.
I know, really.
And actually a federal judge gave the agency 30 days to make the pill, pill available for all ages without a prescription. So, you know, even younger than that.
Amazing. I don't know how that happened.
But now.
But hey, you know what? Kids that age are having sex.
Yeah. And so.
And things happen.
But now the Obama administration is challenging that in court.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
How did I miss that little
nugget? They said that it should be 17. Now, that decision being the one that it makes the morning after pill, and what is it called here? Do you remember?
Plan B.
Plan B. I love this. I could do it. Plan B one step.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Plan A didn't work.
Yes, let's go to Plan B.
Yeah, right. Anyway, said the decision to allow the morning after pill to be available to 15 year holds, which takes effect immediately, represents a compromise on the politically charged issue of access to emergency contraception. Now, get this lineup, folks, and let me know what you think, which has pitted conservative and anti-abortion groups against advocates for women's health and reproductive rights.
Okay.
Well, particularly, and I guess I could ask Jalene this, now, who would you trust? would you trust in the conflict between advocates for women's health and reproductive rights or a bunch of mean old white conservatives and the anti-abortion groups?
It's not them. You know damn right what I think about that.
But get this. Why? I don't even get it. So the anti-abortion group, unless they are going for a totally theological thing, which most of them are, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing is, it's this punitive deal. You know, well, she got herself in trouble.
Yeah.
Now, nobody outside of these anti-abortion groups or these conservatives have used the phrase got in trouble since the 1950s.
When they had to go to the home?
Yeah.
The girls' home?
Something like that. And what they want is, you know, that they want the price of sin. They want the scarlet A, the scarlet letter,
yes,
to be visible. So, you know, they're sweet concern about children. So they want like a 15-year-old to bear a child that, you know, that was
they do.
The result
they,
of a
they
mistake.
Do. Now, wouldn't Plan B for the anti-abortion people, and not that we're pro-abortion, well, doesn't Plan B make more sense than more abortions?
Yeah, it would. It would stop abortions, unless they're saying that every sperm is sacred, to quote Monty Python.
I love that song.
Yeah, yeah, which is really what
the sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
You know this? Come on, more.
That's I'm done. Your wife said we should wait. I'm a singer. That's right.
Yeah, you can sing on the air. I can't. So,
but I'd rather sing a song about things other than sperm. You know?
So is there? I hear you. Is there anybody out there that agrees with these anti-abortion groups and these mean old conservatives that want to keep this Plan B one step?
Mm-hmm.
This day after, am I saying that right?
It's like next day contraception.
Yeah, next day contraception. Out of the hands of young people? Huh? Well, call us, 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment, so get it in if you have something to say about all the conversation we've been having. The FDA said it would make the widely known morning after, that's what it is, morning after pill, available without prescription to girls and women ages 15 and older.
I knew that. Next day pill. Okay, same thing, but do it in the morning.
Yeah. So, but the usual suspects on the right wing pitted conservatives and anti-abortion groups against people that are advocating women, that are advocating for women's health and reproductive rights.
Women's health.
Who should get the say here, for one thing? But what Jalene and I do not understand is why anti-abortion groups would be against this Plan B one step, which would make sure that pregnancy doesn't happen, and then like
and if then I, there won't be this abortion procedure.
Yeah, like obviously if somebody's taking it, they don't want the baby. So this really, right. You know, I always, and I, it's kind of clumsy, but that one of the ways that the anti-abortion groups have been successful is they own language, so they call it pro-life, meaning somehow that the people that want abortion rights
are like, anti-life. die, you know? I mean, please.
Exactly, but I try to use it. Pretty clumsy, but I call them the compulsory pregnancy movement, and this is more evidence, isn't it? This is a, you know, they want to, if you have sex, you got to get pregnant. Well, this is kind of rooted in a number of religions, but
About procreation.
Yeah, this is not where we're at culturally.
And no, it's about pleasure.
So these, you know,
mostly
these right-wing minority little configurations, like the anti-abortion people, the NRA, there's tons of the right to work people, mm-hmm. all this stuff. They have so much clout. It's just amazing. Well,
they're so uptight, for crying out loud.
Yeah, but they got a lot of money. We'll talk about that. The billionaire.
And they're probably way more miserable than those of us who are having great sex. Oh, wait. Did yes. I just say that on the air?
No, I don't. Are we on the air? I want to tell you about, what is it, the Koch brothers, too?
The Koch brothers.
Koch brothers.
Now we're going to a whole new level of low on this show, Peter.
All right. let's go to Houston. Houston's in Ypsilanti. Houston, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
Not much. I've been following the whole Plan B issue.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, unless they're going to change the whole education system and how we're conceiving our cultural values, I don't think that they should really take away Plan B.
Well, they don't want to take it away. They want to make sure that the age doesn't get lowered to 15.
Yeah.
Well, the issue with that is that everyone has this misconception about what Plan B actually is.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, Plan B is actually birth control. So what it does is that it actually helps thicken the uterine wall like normal birth control, if you took the regular pill, would
right.
do, if you're not already on birth control.
Uh-huh.
So that's what it actually does. It doesn't, you know, it's not.
It doesn't abort a baby.
No, it doesn't allow. No. It doesn't allow the fertilization.
First of all, it's not a baby yet.
If you are already pregnant, it's not going to do anything to it because it's already. You've already had. You only have like a 3-day time limit of where you can actually take this pill, anyways. So, and the sooner the better. That's what they say to do because. That like, doesn't give enough time for the sperm to actually reach, you know, the ovaries.
That's like, so, they say the morning after.
The morning after. Yeah. How about the hour after?
Right.
So it's really not any different than taking normal birth control or using a condom, if you really think about it.
Well, you know, Houston, there are people that oppose any birth control as well, and they're pretty powerful in this country. The Catholic Church is still
yeah,
right,
but you
right
know,
there.
We know so many Catholics who...
Well, yeah, the majority of Catholics use birth control. But Houston, let me ask you a question. You have any idea why anti-abortion groups would oppose this?
I think mainly because they don't really understand what it is. Because yeah. I've actually, we've had discussions back at my college when I used to go to college in Ohio about women's rights, and we had a lot of advocates. But the actual town where it was located was very conservative and mostly Republican, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a liberal arts college, it was just in the dead center of this really old-fashioned town.
Where is it?
So,
where are we talking about?
It's in Worcester, Ohio.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's kind of in the boonies, but it's a great school, though. I recommend it. But anywho.
I love that. Anywho.
sorry. Yeah, so we would get these... you know, it was when Joe Biden was coming to visit the school, and we had all these anti-abortion groups, and they were talking about Plan B, and they were saying what it does to fetuses, and that's not true at all.
A fetus?
So,
how can it be the fetus 24 hours
yeah.
later?
So I know, that's what I'm saying,
12
too.
Hours later.
Let's start with that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, Houston, I think these people are just acting off some pretty bizarre set of personal psychology. You know, for one thing, one of the things that that groups that don't want women to have abortion would be to make sure that every woman, and I hate to say it because they won't like it, girl has access to birth control easily
yeah, exactly.
and without shame. I mean, I don't know what to say to, you know, most families, most parents would not like their daughters having sex at 15 or younger,
right.
even. But hey, we live in a modern world. Well, you know what?
My parents never even talked to me about it. It was like the non-issue.
What, birth control or sex? Or
about anything.
No.
Nothing.
Yeah, well, look what happened.
No, I was 18. I saved that until I was 18.
Well, this is
it's getting a little personal.
Houston, this is getting to be confessional radio.
I'm
kind of proud of it, actually.
What an issue also is that just educating people about this taboo subject. Like, sex is still a very taboo subject in the United States.
Isn't that just ridiculous?
And it's really funny because we play it off on TV and it's always talked about in the social media.
Oh, yeah.
But then when it comes down to, like, cultural and, like, family values, people are really scared to talk about it and embarrassed, and it really shouldn't be an embarrassing subject.
Yeah, then when it comes down to doing it, exactly.
Yeah.
Then it becomes an issue, please.
Well, go ahead.
And also, like, because it just going to this school helped me a lot, and a lot of feminist movement was there too. But anywho, we also had, they brought in this speaker, and the actual book that they wrote is I Love Female Orgasm.
Yeah. Okay.
It's an actual book about coming out about how many people are, especially women, are just afraid of their own sexuality.
Yeah.
And it just deals with, like, what actually happens during sex and what should happen. And it's not something that you should feel bad. And the same thing about body image and all these issues. And
hey,
a lot of teenagers.
Not that I need this, but what's the name of that book? Just kidding. Go ahead.
Well, hey, wait.
A lot of teenagers, you were saying.
Yeah.
A lot of teenagers also mostly have sex because of, like, really two reasons.
They want to be
pressure.
Loved.
I would think that's one, but go ahead.
Yeah, peer pressure is mainly the biggest issue here. And...
Wait.
Before I, you know.
I think there is a certain level of that.
Well,
Peter.
There is.
We haven't been teenagers for a long time.
I know. One of the things here, that all species, the imperative is to reproduce, right?
Sure.
So they all have drives and natural ways to do it. And we're the only species that can overlay it with cultural definitions of when and all that. But, you know, there's fecundity. When women are able to conceive, and that's, guess what? It's the same time that the male starts being very interested in that. And that's pretty young. That's pretty young.
It's called puberty. Hello.
Yeah, well, yeah, that made a big deal.
Oh,
you know, Houston, I should go along. But
lots of great points.
Yeah. Hey, I'm sorry. I hope I don't embarrass you, but do you know who Ypsilanti was?
No, actually, I have no idea.
He was a Greek general.
Oh, okay.
Didn't you think he was like an Indian?
Mm-mm.
No, okay.
See, she explained Plan B to us. We explained Ypsilanti to her.
All right. Thank you very much.
Very symbiotic on this show.
Now, what did Ypsilanti do? I think he was in the Greek War for Independence.
Okay.
From who? Would they have been fighting for independence? Turkey.
The
Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
No doubt.
You could probably give me dates, times, and
I'm wrong.
As well.
Greeks or Ypsilantians, let me know. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, what's up?
Hello there. How do you, Jermaine?
Hello, Maurice.
No, well, I'm going to tell you something. Every time you say rock and roll on the air, you know what rock and roll really means?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do.
We do.
What does it mean?
It doesn't mean, well, you tell us, because we just had this conversation, Peter and I did, right before the show, but you tell us.
Is a one phrase that I rock and roll my baby all night long.
Right.
Nothing but sex. But what I really called in for is this.
That's
right. I just was thinking, is this, you said that, Peter?
Yeah. I'm thinking about rocking and rolling.
This country had another war the last 5 to 10 years. It was sending this country an economic war. Okay, and what I think would happen then, there'd be a lot of civil unrest. And, be riots and stuff, and once they invoke Bashar off, the Constitution wouldn't be worth 2 cents, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, because what happens in situations like that, whether it's Lincoln suspending the writ of habeas corpus or the great liberal icon, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, sending Japanese into concentration camps, at that point, or Woodrow Wilson, another great Democratic president whose policy on civil liberties during World War I made George Bush look like a member of the American Civil Liberties Union. So, yeah, when crisis happens, you know, like we want to be secure from illegal search and seizure. On the other hand, when stuff like Boston's happening, wind up with 78% of the people saying, camera surveillance, sure, put it on me all the time, right?
Peter, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Where do you think he went? We have another 10 minutes. Maurice?
Now, let me ask you, do you think what this country is shooting for, that way they have complete control? The laws, the lawyers know nothing. You know, you wouldn't have to worry about going to court. It wouldn't be no court. Everything would be...
Well, I don't think there's anybody's got any big plans, but it's the way things begin to, develop. I mean, it's like I say, pardon me, if you would have said in the 1950s, for instance, right in the middle of the Eisenhower administration, what do you think about putting cameras on every single corner in the United States and having the police watch everybody? People would say, are you crazy?
Like 24/7.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it couldn't be. They don't have...
I did get my sister on one of those cameras back home in Des Moines. Going through a red light. And they did. And they caught her that way. And the car... My dad, you know, was a car dealer, so it was registered to the car dealership, and my dad got the email, and there she is blowing through the stoplight.
All right,
some
Maurice.
Of the best video I've seen Thank all you. Year, by the way. That's kind of creepy.
Well, last September, I visited Chicago. A friend of ours was having an art exhibit there, so I went and spent a few days there, and about 3 weeks, or maybe even like a month and a half later, I get these two letters from Chicago. And each of them has a photograph of me going through a late red light and wanting $100.
Oh, yeah.
A time.
That's what they did. But my sister's was video. I want to tell you what. My sister blew through that.
I don't even know whether I did or I didn't. So it said if you have a justification dispute. Or whatever, a dispute. So, you know, the individual. So I wrote him and I said, there is no evidence that puts me in the driver's seat. I said, I wasn't even necessarily in Chicago. I said, there's nothing to indicate that I was the perpetrator of this illegal left
this
turn.
This does not surprise me. So what happened?
They said, send the money.
Good drive, Morgan.
Damn, I was so angry. I just, I can't believe it. And I don't remember even doing this. I'm a pretty cautious driver, aren't I? I mean, you're designated driver whenever we go to a station function.
You are the designated driver.
Yeah, I counter drinks.
You are my designated driver. I know. You count my drinks, and I don't care. And I tell you exactly how many I drink, and then you pour me out of the car, and it's a good night because I made it home safe.
You know, it's I wonder that's mostly a wife thing. Like, so my wife, when we're at a party, said,
how much have you had to drink?
No. She knows.
Cause she's watching.
She's counting. She's counting drinks.
See, I don't have that because my boyfriend doesn't drink alcohol.
Well, you would almost.
And he doesn't care how many drinks I drink.
As long as you're not driving.
Yeah. Well, I don't drink and drive. I'm militant about that.
I mean, sometimes it's, you know.
I had a couple glasses of wine at your house once, but I live two blocks from you.
Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, I mean, it can be fun when a woman's drinking a little.
And you're not?
Well, and sometimes when you are. Hey, we were talking earlier about globalization, how this country has been deindustrialized, and there's been some unions that have stood up to the attempt to, as the one caller was Paul from Southfield said,
to de-unionize every union
and have the race to the bottom. Well, these Hostess Cupcake unions, remember that a little while ago tried to call the bluff of the owners and wouldn't take this huge pay cut and cut of benefit. And they said, "Hey, sorry, we're closing this all
just like Walmart
up.
Does."
Yeah, well, they're back. Hey, what a success story.
Yay!
You can get your snowballs and ding-dongs.
And your junk food.
And your ho-hos and your Twinkies and all that. But guess what?
What?
The unionized employees are gone.
I know.
We're
so shocked by all this. I knew that snack food would be back, and I knew it would be people not being in a union. And it's tragedy.
A labor attorney said it appears they are discharging the union contract in bankruptcy. Isn't that nice? This is going to happen in Detroit, too, with the this financial emergency financial manager as well. So that's...
Because the new one's gone already, right?
The new what one?
Emergency manager.
No, he just got here.
But I thought he was. I thought
no, that's the guy from the schools.
Oh,
he's been here 2 years.
Which emergency manager? Yeah. Getting him all confused. Yeah. I wish there were none.
They were like, why is there an emergency in Detroit? Because Kwame stole millions.
Right.
Except he didn't steal millions, or he didn't. I don't know. He
just was a little
kickback.
Shady.
No, he got a lot of kickbacks and what have you. This he was evidence of a political unit in collapse. But that gets back to $700 trillion in these derivatives trades. And $700 trillion,
that could do.
Yeah. One of those guys doing it could reach in their pocket and solve Detroit's problems. But one of the things, we forgot all about this because, it's kind of good we forgot about that. That's that we were told that of the four major sports that there was going to be person that came out, and it was NBA veteran Jason Collins that came out, and other than a few little goofballs, there was some guy on ESPN who made some derogatory remark, and they just, I think, kicked his ass off of the network and what have you. And there's been lots of other gay athletes, but this is the first, I believe it is, right? Let's see. Plenty of other athletes around the world have come out as gay either while still active or in
retirement. But usually it would be like a figure skater or a diver
Martina Navratilova. Thank you.
Navratilova. Billie Jean King.
But yeah, lots of them.
Remember her?
Yeah, yeah. But, and it was interesting, President Obama sent, isn't that weird to send a tweet of congratulations?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Better than no tweet, I guess.
Some of these guys, last year, Italy forward in soccer, Antonio Cassano, said he hoped there were no homosexual players on the national team and used a derogatory word to describe gays. Fans of the two-time defending Russian champion Zenit St. Petersburg signed a petition saying gay players were unworthy of our great city. That in the West, if you consider Russia in the West, is the most crazed anti-gay homophobic society around.
I did not know that. I was even surprised at how much that occurred in France.
Well, yeah, that was
really
big.
Surprised me, but now gay marriage is...
But the majority of people, now they're trying to pass a law in Russia that if you advocate gay rights, they can put you in jail.
God, that is terrible.
Marcello Lippi, Italy's World Cup winning manager, caused a stir in 2009 when he said he had never come across a gay player and would advise gay players to stay in the closet.
Yeah, nice guy.
Yeah, so you're wondering, what's the big deal to these guys? I mean, because
physical contact, and that's what I think a lot of
locker room,
that kind of thing. And you know what? They're not looking at you. And when there's physical contact on the football field, it's about kicking someone's ass. It's not about I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, part of this argument is old-fashioned, 20th century stuff, is that why don't they just keep it to themselves?
Yeah. So why? Yeah. Stay in the closet.
Yeah.
And don't be an authentic,
full
human being.
And if you think that's just Jillian and me speaking here. Gareth Thomas, a Welsh rugby star, attracted widespread media attention in 2009 when he announced he was gay, and he played for another couple of years. And get this is a thing, if you can put yourself in the place of somebody else, you can't completely ever.
True.
And I can't. But he said, I was like a ticking time bomb. I thought I could suppress it, keep it locked away in some dark corner of myself, but I couldn't. It was who I was, and I just couldn't ignore it anymore. I've been through every emotion under the sun trying to deal with this, he said in a recent documentary.
No one should ever have to live that way.
Absolutely.
Be free. Be free to be who you are, not who you're pretending to be, or, that's who you are.
Orlando Cruz of Puerto Rico came out in October as pro boxing's first openly gay fighter, saying, I don't want to hide any of my identities. I want people to look at me for the human being I am. And the idea that this still has to take courage means we're not where we should be.
We're not there at all. We're not there about race. We're not there about gender. We're not there about homosexuality.
You know what? I actually think that we are more there about gay issues than about gender or certainly about race.
Race, yeah.
Yeah, because ultimately it doesn't affect anybody. I mean, gay marriage, because remember that Supreme Court decision, and the people that were supporting the constitutional ban in California couldn't even come up with how it harmed anyone.
Yeah.
Straight people, gay people, children, anybody.
Just their own fear.
Yeah. Well, they said that it was against tradition.
Yeah. Whose?
It was theirs.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean.
So they're going to make their tradition everybody else's.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's called authoritarian.
I think that's called closed-minded.
All right. Just a few finishing things. Want to get on to these interviews that I did recently. And first one is about fracking. Don't frack Michigan. Right?
Yes, don't ruin our water
supply.
Yeah,
this is a good environmental thing. Jolene was saying we don't pay enough attention to the environment. And
We don't focus as much on that as we do.
Well, I was thinking even as a society.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, all right.
No question.
And then the other one.
Meanwhile, the big trending story on Yahoo is that Justin Bieber got attacked, okay? You know? I mean, this is what's wrong with America.
The other one is with Ray Raphael, a very interesting man who writes about the Constitution, which I know Jolene says don't say that.
Just say what it's about.
This is very interesting.
Thank you.
What we get wrong about the Constitution and how to make it right.
You know what, Peter? After all these years together, I don't know. I may be able to train you eventually.
Old dog, no new trick. Candy, thanks for doing the work in the other
room. Thank you so much for coming in this week, Candy. Great job.
We'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. 101 WRIF.
Welcome to
everything that rocks.
Jim Twitchell's the senior master technician at Ford, and once he starts talking brakes, there's no stopping him.
Brakes are the most important system on your car as far as I'm concerned. And when we do an inspection, we check the pads and shoes for thicknesses. We check the rotors and drums.
Get Motorcraft Brake Service with up to $50 in mail-in rebates when you use the Ford Service credit card. Click on the banner ad now. Taxes extra. Rebate by check subject to credit approval. Pads or shoes on most cars and light trucks. One axle. Excludes machining, rotors, or drums. See participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 531-13.
101 WRIF.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Personality. I know you're in ya. I know you're dreaming.
can do for you.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Let's go to work, Greg, because it'll make you run.
Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me, Peter Werby, here with you. You know, in politics these days, everybody's saying everything is so contentious and so partisan. This isn't like the old days. Well, that's not true. The old days, all the old days, were just filled with political arguments. Think about the origins of this country, slavery, the women's votes, the labor movement, anti-war, all of that. There's always been great contentious political arguments, and there's always consequences to policy turning out to favor one side or the other. Sometimes they're grievous, and particularly it's true. Well, I don't know if I would say particularly, but let's go that way. Particularly it's true with the environment, because if some people say, well, we should log this old growth forest, well, it's done. And then if it turns out to create mudslides and we've lost this natural heritage treasure, well, we have. Or as people say, well, genetically modified organisms are okay. And other people say, you're letting loose Frankenstein genes into the biosphere. Once they're there, they're there. Well, it's true also with a process called fracking. And this is about how a natural gas is being brought up from the surface. And you've probably seen all these ads on television. It's a new future. We don't have to deal with ugly coal and what that brings, you know, oil with its toxic qualities and wars fought for it and all that. We've got all this great natural gas right under the state of Michigan. Well, the process is called fracking, and we'll get you the technical term for it in a minute. Joining us is Ellis Bowl. He is an activist with the BanMichiganFracking.org, so you see what side of the question he's on. He's also an attorney, and he's got lawsuits pending in the Michigan Court of Appeals against fracking. And he's also the one of the most important definitions, an old friend of mine, and we're reaching him in his, I believe, in his office in Charlevoix. Ellis.
That's correct.
Ellis Bowl.
Hello, Peter.
Welcome to the broadcast. I'm doing great. Thanks for joining me. Well, let's do this. Let's begin with assuming that there are people that have no idea. Fracking? What the, you know, what is that? What? Give me the kind of technical info that we need.
Yes, Peter. It takes a couple minutes to explain, so just interrupt me if I'm getting technical.
No, I'm sitting back.
Fracking, the word frack is not a pejorative term that we dreamed up. It's an industry-originated term. Frack is short for fracture, and fracture is short for hydraulic fracture. And what hydraulic fracturing is about, or fracking, is a method of drilling for natural gas or oil. And in Michigan, it's gas. There's not oil that's being fracked around here, at least that I'm aware of. And what's fracking has been done for decades in Michigan in vertical wells, going back 20, 30, 40 years. But a new method of drilling for gas or oil has been developed recently that employs horizontal bores. It's really quite interesting and intriguing how they've been able to figure out how to drill horizontally. They go down a mile, 2 miles deep vertically, and then they turn the bore in a horizontal direction and go another 2 miles out that way, or 2 miles. And what fracking is once they drill down 2 miles and then drill horizontally 2 miles, then they take their drilling equipment away, bring in other equipment, and set off little pipe bombs, little explosions down below, which fracture the rock. The rock that they're aiming for in Michigan is shale, and the particular level of shale or area of shale that we are concerned about is a level called the Utica Cullingwood. And so by putting fractures in the rock so deep in the ground, that frees gas that otherwise would be locked in the pores of the rock to flow through these fractures to the wellbore and then up to the surface. And it seems like a benign process if you think about it.
Well, I was going to say, sounds okay so far. We get natural gas out of it.
Right.
Sounds good.
Haven't got to the the worst part.
Yeah. Right.
Trying to be objective here. They don't just send water down to do that. Hydraulic means using water. 99 or 98, 99% of what they shoot down in those bores is water. They also send down sand, and the reason for the sand is to prop open the fractures once they've been created or expanded.
And this is to force up the natural gas that they've unlocked.
Well, the gas is lighter than air. It floats to the surface under its own power. It doesn't need to be forced, but the water does need to be forced down there at tremendously high pressure. But they also use chemicals with the water and with the sand. And some of the chemicals are benign, but some of them are terrible and awful, carcinogenic or endocrine disruptors. There's one that I've become familiar with that's being used by the big fracker in Michigan is a company called Encana, E-N-C-A-N-A. And Encana's got several wells and plans for several more coming, mostly in the northern lower peninsula in Kalkaska County is where it tends to be concentrated. And one of the chemicals that Encana has been using is called Acid Inhibitor 2, or AI-2. And I got a copy of... through Freedom of Information, got a copy of the material safety data sheet for this AI-2. And it's got four ingredients, and one of the four is proprietary, meaning XXX, meaning they won't tell you what it is. You have to sue them to get it. And that, you know, maybe is not so bad because there's a lot of proprietary things in life that you're not told what it is. But the material safety data sheet says that this AI-2 is lethal to breathe, lethal to ingest. It is explosive. It can catch on fire. There may be containers of it that you think are empty containers, and they're really not empty. And if you bang them or heat them or braise them, they may blow up and cause death.
Well, in fact, I will interrupt you here. My guest is Ellis Ball. He's an activist and also an attorney. He's got lawsuits in against fracking in Michigan, that process where they're bringing natural gas to the surface. And he works with banmichiganfracking.org. That's the website you can go to. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. So I want to stop you right there and saying it's ban Michigan fracking. Why not just say ban Michigan fracking with chemicals and just use the water and the sand and we'll get the gas and there won't be these toxics being injected into the earth, which, wind up in our, water systems?
Well, that's an interesting proposition, Peter, except the industry has no interest in it. Only you and I have an interest in it. They use these chemicals because it helps them get the gas out. There's several different reasons and several different chemicals. One of them is one class of chemicals is a biocide to kill the little bacteria that are down there so deep in the ground. There are surfactants. There are friction reducers. There's several other categories of chemicals. And if they didn't use the chemicals, it just wouldn't work for them. Economically, they would just walk away.
Oh, okay. So that's the devil's choice always. What I call capitalist blackmail. Do you want, the environment harmed or do you want energy and jobs? We got to come up with something better than that, but go ahead, please.
There's an argument against fracking even if they didn't use the bad chemicals. And this is not so much against fracking per se as against gas itself, natural gas itself. Natural gas is usually thought of as one of the better fossil fuels. It burns cleaner. It doesn't have mercury in it. It doesn't have, I believe it's sulfur. There's some bad things which coal and oil have, which gas doesn't have when you burn it. And so it's cleaner and better for the environment.
Sure.
But Natural gas is mostly methane, and methane is a greenhouse gas. And a significant amount of the methane, when they bring it up out of the ground, escapes unburned. There's leaky valves, it just goes into the atmosphere unburned. And methane is a 20 times more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Wow.
And if you're concerned about global warming, as I am, not everyone is, but I am. I expect many of your listeners are. This is going to be a big problem for not just Michigan, but for the world.
Well, let me just insert this, and I'm always trying to anticipate what audience may be thinking. They say, you environmentalists, which means you, Ellis Bowl, and me, Peter Werby, you know, you don't want us to use coal, you don't want us to use oil, you don't want us to use gas. What are we supposed to do, hook everything up to a bicycle and pedal, you know, which might not be a bad idea. But it sounds to some people
we're
cutting the ground out from under the energy requirements of this industrial society.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think society has got to change its ways in ways that we don't anticipate. Even the left did not anticipate until recent years. And fossil fuels have ancillary damaging qualities, just like nuclear has. Nuclear waste has to be dealt with, and they haven't figured it out now after decades of that. And I think they're going to have the same problem with gas, just as you have with coal and with oil. And you're right. We're an industrial society, and there's going to have to be a change in the nature of society, I believe. We can go to solar. We can go to wind. I know there's problems with those fuel sources being intermittent. The sun doesn't shine at night. The wind doesn't always blow. So it's going to require a change in our lifestyle, not just in our lifestyle, but the whole world's lifestyle. And that's strong medicine, but this is something that we're all concerned about. Even the ruling class is perking up to this a little bit, I noticed.
Well, the problem always seems to me is that that it's sort of takes disasters. It takes a Fukushima for people to examine nuclear power and whether that's dangerous or not, or the fact that we have absolutely nowhere to store the nuclear waste. What's happening with oil and coal and gas is that it's death of a thousand cuts, so it's not really in our face, and we can still get in our cars and turn on our lights and what have you. And most people don't associate, like, wars and Iraq and Afghanistan with the cost of the human cost, for instance, of oil. So tell us.
Well, I'm sorry about that, and we just have to educate.
Yeah, well, that's what
Michigan,
I. Yeah, go ahead.
Michigan, the problem with Michigan's regulatory setup these days, one way to interpret the question you asked me a moment ago is, can't this be regulated properly so that fracking can be done?
Right.
And we have two answers to that. Number one is that, and I'm going to give several examples in over the next few minutes of the DEQ, which is the department which handles this, the Department of Environmental Quality, and particularly the Office of Oil, Gas, and Minerals within the DEQ. There's several examples where the DEQ just doesn't do its job and won't follow its own regulations. But there's a stronger, more fundamental argument here, and that is, even if the DEQ were conscientious and even if the regulations were very strict, it's still going to be a problem for the planet, because there's no regulation that they can put into place to address the issue of forest fragmentation. For instance, in Kana, the big fracker company that I mentioned a minute ago has announced plans to its investors for 1,700 well locations in the northern lower peninsula that largely overlaps the area where Kirtland warblers are being planned for in the northern lower peninsula.
Which have just, by the way, been almost saved from extinction. So it's
I understand they're about to be delisted, but they're still going to require monitoring. Other species which have been delisted have flourished and thrived and don't need any more monitoring, but the Kirtlands are always going to need need monitoring to keep them from going back on the endangered list. And some of these wells are right in Kirtland Territory. One of my cases is raises that question that the Public Service Commission granted pipeline easements or pipelines for two Encana gathering lines. They're right in Kirtland Territory, and they took no notice of it. There was an environmental impact assessment attached to the application that made no mention whatever of Kirtland warblers. And my two clients have seen Kirtlands in their backyard, and they like them. You know, they're beautiful birds. And
well, there's something
sing a beautiful song.
Yeah, there's something. Even people that couldn't, you know, that aren't birders, and you know, kind of birds are birds, but still, there's something frightening about extinction. Ellis Bowl is my guest. He's an activist and an attorney with Ban Michigan Fracking. You can go to their website, banmichiganfracking.org, and the suits he was talking about are lawsuits he has against fracking that are in the Michigan Court of Appeals. And there'll be a link to all of this on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. But Ellis, go ahead with what you were saying.
Well, There's more that can be done than simply go to our website and become educated, because I'm involved, and my wife, Lou Ann Cosma, was the originator of this, and I hand it off to her. It was all her idea. There's a petitioning campaign going on right now that seeks to put on the ballot in November of next year a proposition to ban horizontal hydraulic fracturing in Michigan, as well as storage of waste, horizontal hydraulic fracturing waste. And so the additional website that I would recommend your listeners take a look at if they want to participate in this, because this is something where you can actually do something, not just read up on it, but you can be a part of it, is letsbanfracking.org. And you can sign up there to be a volunteer and to circulate petitions, and we'd like to each volunteer to get 150 or 200 signatures throughout the course of the summer up till October 1. That's our ending date. There's another aspect of this campaign I want to draw your attention to, and that of your listeners, and that is in addition to a ballot option that would ban horizontal fracking, and there's a provision in Michigan law right now that's been in effect since 1939 that requires the environmental regulators to foster the oil and gas industry favorably with a view to the ultimate recovery of the maximum maximum production of oil and gas. Can you believe it? Mm. That's written into our statute that these environmental regulators are supposed to foster the oil and gas industry. That means, of course, fostering profits, and that means fostering more global warming. They're not just fostering gas, they're also fostering oil. And so one of the things that this petition will do will be to remove that, to repeal that which has been in effect since 1939, and in its place put a requirement that the regulators foster human health and water.
Well, here's what I'm fearful of, and we've seen some of these initiatives that we thought were excellent go down to defeat. Think about 2012, and here.
Yes, that doesn't apply to us.
Well, wait a minute. Let me just finish my thought.
Go ahead.
I suspect you'll be able to get this on the ballot because people will be concerned. You have very persuasive arguments, and so it gets on the initiative, and your group raises, say, $200,000 to support it. In the meantime, the gas industry comes in with $17 million to oppose it. It really is. We environmentalists really are David fighting Goliath. And I know sometimes, you know, the story is that David wins, but, you know, unfortunately, mostly Goliath does.
Well, the alternative is to give up and go home and put your head between your legs.
No, I agree. I mean, well, the other stuff, I mean, people have done in all sorts of campaigns is direct action. You know, I mean, why we should have, we're being poisoned. I mean, why, and I know other people have tried to do stuff and, you know, wound up with, something like this. And I'm sure you experienced it. You wind up with 75 people at the protest. That's not enough.
There is a direct act. There have been direct actions at the mineral gas auctions, and there's one coming up in Lansing on May 9th, and I'm going to be there. I've been there for the last two, and when people have gotten arrested, I've stepped in and given a hand, as well as the National Lawyers Guild. And so far, things haven't gotten out of hand, and the idea of having an Occupy action at one of these Encana wells is something that's under discussion and may take place soon.
You know me. You know I don't think we should do nothing, and I'm not opposing a ballot initiative. I'm just wondering whether you think of its chances of success.
We think we can convince people. And we're willing to take the chance. We think the chance should be taken. We think this should be decided politically, not through lobbyists and committees and scientists and experts. This is something that should be brought into the open and people talk to their neighbors and sometimes get angry at each other. But this is the sort of thing that deserves the light, the sunshine, to put it on this issue and be decided politically.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's a risk. We might lose them. Then maybe the people will vote for gas. But we think it's a risk that needs to be taken.
You know, you hear some of these horror stories, like in a documentary I haven't seen, like Gasland, where I think that was in Pennsylvania, where people could actually open their water faucet and light it.
Yes, that's true. There is a methane sometimes that comes out of the ground naturally, and there are people who have been able to light their water on fire just through natural conditions, or put a match down to a stream out in the wilderness and light it on fire. But there was a study out of Duke a couple of years ago that examined one particular county in Pennsylvania and found that a well that was within a kilometer, a water well, which was within a kilometer of a gas well, was 17 times more likely to have methane in it than if it was more than a kilometer away.
Hmm. Well, you know, there may be some people listening who think, well, this is pretty one-sided, and it is, but if you think about all the ads on television for natural gas, and essentially the natural gas is coming from fracking, this is just a very, very small answer. But Ellis Bull, we've got about 2 minutes left. You've debated the other side. You've debated people from the natural gas industry that are involved in fracking. But what do they say? They say you're Chicken Little, right? The sky is not falling.
They say that fracking. I mean, one of our big points is that fracking uses tremendous amounts of water, 30 million gallons of water per well. And they say, well, actually, burning methane creates water, which it does. In a chemical equation, but that water doesn't fall back into the watershed. It gets whirled around the world and falls into the ocean or falls into wet tropical places. Another issue is radium. The DEQ did some frack flowback and found radium 226 and 228 at levels of over 2,000 picocuries per liter each, and the EPA's maximum allowable level for drinking water is 5 picocuries per liter. I've emailed Hal Fitch, the head of the DEQ Oil and Gas Division, about this, and he hasn't answered. Says there was frack flowback that was spread on roads in a campground right next to the Mackinac Bridge last summer without the knowledge of the campground. They knew that stuff was being spread on the roads. They didn't know it contained frack flowback. I'm giving you examples of DEQ not following its own rules. Since we only have a minute or two left, one of my lawsuits is about the failure of the DEQ to enforce its rules for injection wells onto frack wells. And a frack well is an injection well because they inject millions of gallons of water. But if they enforce the injection well rules onto frack wells, then the chemical constituents would have to be disclosed to nearby landowners so they could do baseline testing. The EPA refuses to do that.
Well, we unfortunately are out of time. I'm reminded of this kind of chilling little fragment from an E.E. Cummings poem, which he said, "I don't want to startle you, but they mean to kill us all." And we are being faced on so many fronts with assaults on what sustains particularly our life, but the life of so many other species. Fracking is one of them, and we've just had an eloquent presentation of the problems on one hand, and probably most important, how we can address fixing it. So you can go to banmichiganfracking.org, and for the election, putting this on the ballot, the question, are we going to continue to do this to our environment, is at letsbanfracking.org. If it's too much for you all to get while you're driving, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And my guest has been Ellis Ball. He's an attorney and an activist with banmichiganfracking.org. I want to thank you, Ellis, so much for being on the program.
Okay.
And we will check back with you perhaps in the months to come to see how this effort is going. Thank you.
Feel good.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Think about the U.S. Constitution. In fact, most people, I don't know, they're kind of bored, something like they had in high school civics class. But think about all the current disputes about policy, about laws, debt and deficits, taxes, and all of that. It all goes back to a written document that was pretty unique in world history. Men sat down in a room, put together a foundation document that spelled out exactly, they thought, exactly what government should do, could do, and couldn't do. And also, then as a little addendum, put together some rights saying, hey, we can do this, the government can't do that. And so, end of story. Well, of course not. And so, everyone for their political cause always cites the Constitution. Going back into the 1830s and 1840s, the slave owners justified slavery via the Bible, for instance, when you talk about ambiguous documents. And at the same time, the abolitionists cited the Bible as a way to abolish slavery. And much the same has occurred with the Constitution. Constitution in 1 year says segregation is okay. Well, in fact, slavery was okay, and then it's not okay. Then segregation's okay. Then it's not. Let's try to get through some of this and what we could call these pretty much. And this is the name of the book that we're going to be talking about: constitutional myths, myths about the Constitution, what we get wrong, and how to get it right. And the author is Ray Raphael. He's a senior research fellow at Humboldt State University in Northern California. He's written 16 books, including A People's History of the American Revolution, Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past, and Mr. President, How and Why the Founders Created a Chief Executive. We're reaching Ray Raphael in his office in Northern California, and it must be a nice place to be. Ray Raphael, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, pleased to be talking with you, Peter.
So you, I was talking about the ambiguity of the documents. The Founding Fathers, Did they leave it open for ambiguity, or did they think that that they had settled everything that they had written about?
No, they certainly did leave it open, because they knew that they couldn't stipulate absolutely every minutiae. It just government doesn't work that way. Their idea was to create not the rules for what we do, but a structure within which we can determine our own rules. So they had certain things are cut and dry. The president has to be 35 years old. Other things are not so cut and dry. In the powers listed for Congress, they listed some of them, but they knew they couldn't get everything just down to the last little thing. Like Congress has a power to build lighthouses or something, or has the power to make some law about something. So they had, in the end, they put in this, what they call the necessary and proper clause. It has the necessary and proper, the power to implement any length that's necessary and proper to implement the preceding laws. They knew they needed this some kind of leeway here, and nobody objected to that. Everybody understood that when that provision was put in there was no debate at all. And at the end of the Constitutional Convention, everybody, nobody was totally satisfied with the document. They'd all given up a bunch because it was an act of compromise, many acts of compromise. But they came together with the notion that they needed some kind of government because they didn't have a government yet. All they had was a confederation. And they were going to get this thing up and rolling, get it on the road, and then people would kind of work with that and have that be the evolving document.
Well, has it worked? I mean, it's so all over the board. Like, yes, I think, and I want to talk about this later, I mean, many of us think that the Constitution as a document of freedom and liberty was sullied by its inscribing slavery in it, but then it was constitutionally abolished. And as I said earlier, in the 1890s, segregation was upheld as constitutional, and then in 1954, it was held as unconstitutional. So it seems like it's more subject to prevailing political winds.
Well, it is, and you can call them prevailing political winds, or you can call them evolving sentiments of the times. Let me give you an example. The Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. Okay, what do you think of that, Peter? When you say cruel and unusual punishment, what sounds like cruel to you?
Well, I think, I may know a little about this. When I think of that, I think of how they reflected on the kind of tortures that were administered in Europe and in England where they had come from, and that they wanted to abolish that. Am I correct?
Yeah, precisely.
Okay.
And they thought, but on the other hand, hanging was fine.
Yeah.
So a lot of people today say, well, since hanging was fine, of course the death penalty's fine. And also another thing that was perfectly fine and perfectly usual and not at all cruel was branding somebody's hands and lashing them, administering lashes. And so today, that amendment is still there. Nothing's been changed in the written Constitution. But can you imagine today a local sheriff is brought to trial basically by a prisoner because the sheriff branded his hand and lashed him,
mm-hmm.
right, for shoplifting. Okay, can you imagine a judge saying, "Well, no, that's fine. That's in the Constitution. It's perfectly. You know, that's the way they thought. They thought that was usual." So that shows that it's not just a political whim. It's an evolving cultural norm. That the general sense of cruel and unusual, that's like the principle, but how you apply that does in fact change with time. And these guys knew about change. They lived through the Enlightenment. Things were changing all around them. The last thing they wanted to do was to say, we have the final answer for all time, because they wanted to establish a republic where people are free to elect their own representatives, and those representatives have the discretion to govern, to pass wise laws for governance. And they couldn't, if everybody had to do things exactly the way the founders wanted to do them in 1787, people wouldn't be free anymore. That's not a free republic.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Ray Raphael. You can go to his website, rayraphael.com. His last name is spelled RAPHAEL.com. And we're talking about his newly published book, one of many he's written, Constitutional Myths, How We Get It Wrong and How to Get It Right. It's published by The New Press. I'm holding in my hand a constitution, and this is published by the American Civil Liberties Union. And so they're considered on the left, which is kind of strange to me in a way, because they're trying to enforce the provisions of the Constitution, particularly, although not exclusively, the Bill of Rights. And yet they get so much criticism often from the right wing. How does fair question even, but how does the ACLU get branded as left wing for trying to enforce the provisions of the Bill of Rights?
Well, I can't really. I'm no expert on current partisanship, although I pay attention like everybody else. And my expertise is actually in the history field. And when I look at a lot of these people, whether it's ACLU or anybody else, taking positions on the Constitution, the first thing that I do is look at it historically. And historically, when you think of, when most people think of, and certainly the ACLU thinks this way, and most people think this way, right or left, when you think of the Constitution, don't you immediately think of your rights? You
sure.
Know, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to give you rights. You know, this is not historically how we have a Constitution. Historically, we have a Constitution because before 1787, there was no federal government. There was a confederation, and the only governments that could do such things as pass laws and levy taxes were the states. And that, in the minds of the framers, was not working out. So they wanted to create a workable government, and to do that, they needed to create a federal authority. They called it the supreme law of the land, that had the final say in things, and this government had to be. And these are favorite words of them of theirs. It had to be energetic and vigorous. Had to have vigor. Now, this was their purpose, to create the government, and they worked. They toiled and they compromised for 3.5 months. And on September 12th, only 5 days before they wind up the journey, George Mason says, well, we've done all this thing. Here's this document. What about a Bill of Rights? Let's get a Bill of Rights. And he's kind of all pumped up about it, and so is Eldridge Gerry. And they're the only two. And they can't get the votes of a single state delegation. So the framers themselves, here's the rights that you have. You know, it's all about rights, really. Well, here's your rights. No ex post facto laws. You know, you can't make a law kind of that applies for something that's already happened. No bills of attainder. That's the things that apply to specific people. And you have the you have a right to writ of habeas corpus and a trial in civil criminal cases.
And this is in the main body of the Constitution.
That's in the main body.
So there's not much else. Yeah.
Those are your rights. Nothing else. Sorry. Yeah. Nothing about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, gun rights, anything. Nothing. To them, that was incidental. To them, there were bills of rights and declarations of rights in the states. They said, well, these will suffice. That's good enough. And so, historically, their main purpose of the Constitution, sorry, folks, was not about rights, the way the framers did it. Now, how do we have the Bill of Rights? Because out of doors, a lot of people said, oh, wow, this is a pretty strong federal government, and we better make sure that they don't get too strong, so we are going to push for a Bill of Rights. And then by doing that, through a sort of complex act of political compromise, they got some of the Federalists, the people who were supporting the Constitution, in particular James Madison and George Washington, to give ground a little and do a Bill of Rights. But it came in, it wasn't the main function. And if you are waving your Constitution in the air and say the point of this thing was to create your rights, that's not historically correct. The point of it was to create a strong government, but a strong government with defined powers that wasn't too strong. But you have to have that government in the formula somewhere. It's not just all about individual rights.
But this is beginning with the First Amendment and so many of them. These have been the areas of contention throughout American history. And particularly the First Amendment is just extraordinary. That it essentially says that people are no longer subjects, but they are citizens, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, to steal some language from another document. And the idea that ordinary people could do things like criticize the government, get together with people and say, hey, we don't like what you're doing, all of that. And the first one, I often say, what's the first guarantee of a right that is in the amendments? And people always say, oh, the right to free speech. And I said, no, that it's that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, which said to me, Ray Raphael, I need you to say whether I'm perpetuating a myth or not, because in your book, Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right, we'll see whether this is a myth of mine, that, again, they looked at the European experience, and they saw what happened with the conjunction of religion and the state, and it always harmed both of them. And so that's the first thing that they address. How am I doing?
Well, you're doing good, but I'm gonna have to refine that. You're doing very good, Peter. keep coming. But I'm gonna have to refine it historically a little, because people look at these things in the grammar of them and the placement and whether there's a comma or not in the Second Amendment between militia clause and the other, and they parse these things as if they were fine-tuned to an absolute T, when in fact, in the main body, they were just cobbled together. In the main body, the whole structure of the government was changed with less than 2 weeks to go, and they had they didn't have time to fine-tune it. Now, you look at that First Amendment. Why is the freedom of religion there first? Who wrote the First Amendment? It was James Madison. Mm-hmm. Why did he write it? He wrote it because people had, for two reasons. One is people had suggested lots of structural changes to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And he in Washington said, we can't have these structural changes. In particular, the people outside were clamoring to weaken the Congress's power to tax. And they said, no, the power to tax is absolute. We can't weaken that. So we're going to give them a Bill of Rights, but we won't change things like the power to tax. And so now Madison is writing these things. Now, Madison is from Virginia, and he had opposed a Bill of Rights. But when he's facing election to be a U.S. representative, and he is opposing an anti-federalist, actually James Monroe, a lot of his constituents are Baptists, and he promises them to have a Bill of Rights. He promises that he's going to push for freedom of religion. And he personally very much believes in freedom of religion because he and Jefferson had pushed through a statute of religious freedom in Virginia. He didn't speak for all the framers. The people up in Massachusetts, they weren't into it. They were into state-supported religion. But Madison penned it, and that's what got approved. So that's a complex answer. Sorry for the complexity.
No, folks, I love it.
But if you're looking at the meaning of the Constitution, you've got to pay some attention to the historical context in which that was, or you're going to exaggerate certain. You get these theories about what's more important or less important than others that are just off the wall. What we have now,
well, or we overlay, and I'm probably guilty of this, overlay our current political views onto what arises as the most important.
Yep, exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And that's what kind of got me riled up and I am riled up. I'm not riled up about one issue or another. This is not a partisan book, folks, by the way. I'm riled up as a historian to see people parsing this thing, and somehow the parsing always comes out the way they want it. And let me give you another example of this. You know, originalism, original intent, right?
Right,
and
of the founding fathers, yeah.
Yeah, and there's kind of two versions of originalism. One is by Justice Thomas. He wants original intent. The other is by Scalia. He says it's not the intent of the framers. It's the meaning of the words of his times. But in either case, if they can construct an argument based on originalism, they will do it if it supports their cause. But now I'm going to, you guys know about, I bet people up in Michigan know about this case called Citizens United, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Absolutely. Of
freedom
course.
Of speech for corporations.
Yeah. So freedom, okay. So this gives, it's basically just saying that corporations have no restrictions on speech and influence over government. And actually struck down a law trying to just contain, just put that in perspective, just put some limits on it. Now, if you are an originalist, you have to ask, what would the framers think about that? Did the framers think that corporations are people?
No.
That doesn't sound really like the framers, does it?
As a matter of fact,
they were very suspicious of corporations. The whole monopoly of the East India Company was what started the whole Boston Tea Party. And any corporation had at that time to be very strictly limited for a specific purpose and was for a specific period of time. And they were not unrestricted, and they were certainly not granted the rights of people. And what about a speech is money? Did they really think that you could buy your way into just flooding the market with anything, and with, and that really was what freedom of speech meant?
Mm-hmm.
And how's this one? Influence over government. The very essence, the core of our founding principles was that private interests should not control government. That was the whole point. That's why you elected leaders who would be impartial, and they would make decisions. And so now the idea that we have no restriction over private influence over the government is just absolutely 180 degrees counter. So the originalist argument against Citizen United is ironclad if you're an originalist. So why don't they offer that argument? Because that's not the conclusion they want to reach. So they say there's originalism, but they only do it when they want it. That's an argument about that way of interpreting the Constitution, but it kind of applies to all of us because we all kind of reason backwards from the conclusion that we want to what we, and then we create the historical Constitution, which is bogus. And that's why I say let's reverse this. That's what I did in Constitutional Myths. Let's reverse this process.
That's
let's start with the real Constitution historically. then at least we know what we're dealing with, and we can figure out how to interpret it.
Ray Raphael is my guest, and he has a website where you can see his book and other things. There's many books he's written. Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. It's published by the New Press. His website is Ray Raphael. That's last name is RAPHAEL.com. It's also, we've got to spell all these last names. It's on my website as well as a link. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. We are barely, I mean, that's why people write books, listeners. We are barely scratching the surface in terms of the information that's in here, the examination of how this document, this foundation document of our nation came into being. So I highly recommend it. And I think we maybe have time for one more. I'm going to test myself again, and because some of the things that I say on the air, I hope I am not repeating constitutional myths. But in a way, this is an opinion that the compromise about the allowing the existence of slavery not only was, was certainly a political necessity to bring the U.S., to begin first the rebellion and then to have an agreement about the Constitution. But it not only, it didn't just sully the Constitution ethically and morally, but it also created problems that continue today. I don't know, maybe this isn't a constitutional question so much as a political and ethical question.
Well, there's all kinds of ways to go at that one. It was a compromise that if they wanted to have a nation, they probably would have needed to make, because there's no, or at least if it was going to include all the South and the North together. But that said, you have to say, well, was it worth that or not? I mean, you can second guess it or anything, but one thing that really interests me is the extent of how this reveals what an intensely political document it is. 3/5. Does anybody out there in Radio Land know how they came up with that number of 3/5? A slave is worth 3/5 of a compromise.
Well, I know from reading your book, but go ahead, tell us. No, I don't think anybody does. It was just like a further humiliation of African slaves.
Yeah, but why didn't they come, 0.25 or anything else, 3/5? Well, here's what happened is, remember, the South wanted all the slaves counted, and the North didn't want any of the slaves counted, so they figured 3/5. 4 years before, they were figuring out how much taxes each state should pay. The South said, oh, you can't tax our slaves. They're not people or anything. I mean, you can't tax them. And the North said, you have to tax all those slaves. They're working and producing things. And so the total reverse of the positions that they would have in 1787. And in that earlier time, they had settled on 3/5. To satisfy both needs. So this time, even though the sides had diametrically switched positions, because now we're talking about representation instead of taxes, they said, well, let's crank out that old fraction. It worked for them. That's the level at which this thing was made. And you can call it a sacred document, but I think that pretty much establishes it's nothing sacred about it. What it was they were trying to get a workable document, and it could be improved later. And thank God the slavery one was. And we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which are really kind of a constitution in their own right. And so this thing did evolve. It evolved through amendments, the amendment process, and it's evolved through the mending, evolving meanings of the times, like the 14th Amendment, equality. In 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, they said separate but equal. And half a century later, 1954, they say there's no such thing as separate but equal, because they had figured that out in time, and we do figure it out in time. So it's still a fixed, it's still a document that bear, it's still our foundation, but how we read that document has to move according to how we move as well.
Well, is it fair to say that since this Constitution arose in the era of the democratic revolutions in Europe and here, that it was about the expansion of, it was about inclusion, because it began with white property, now we can say heterosexual males, which left a whole lot of folks out, and we've been in a process of including eventually everyone.
Yeah, well, that's it. I'll tell you, the founders didn't want to include everybody.
No, I know.
They barely wanted to. They didn't even want to include non-property-owning white males.
Right.
And it was really, it's pushed from outside and from history in the way those things have changed and evolved. But it is not a democratic document. They were talking about people electing wise leaders and then stepping aside, and the wise leaders would decide things. And that process has changed through the early 19th century and so on till today, where we don't accept that anymore.
Let me just cut you short, because we have less than a minute. And does the Constitution need further amendment in your estimation, or isn't that for you to estimate?
Well, I'll tell you, amendments at this point in time are going to be very difficult, because how are you going to have three-fourths of the states, three-fourths of anybody in this partisan climate to agree on anything? Whoever thinks they're getting the raw deal in that is not going to vote for it. So really, that's not a viable way. Maybe it should happen, but it's not going to happen. So what we have to do is we have to take a more realistic look at looking at the historic Constitution, which I do in constitutional myths, and then seeing, well, now we have our needs today and what's happened since then, and how do we mesh these two in a way that works for us, that's really a viable government, because that's what the founders wanted us to have above everything else, is a viable government.
Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Ray Raphael. Go to his website, RayRaphael, RaphaeL.com. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. He's written Constitutional Myths, What We Get Wrong and How to Get It Right. If you want to figure out what these political arguments are about, partisanship, go back into our history. It really shines a light on us. Ray Raphael, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks so much. What a joy to be talking with you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
Riff.
Jim Twitchell's a senior master technician at Ford, and once he starts talking brakes, there's no stopping it.
Brakes are the most important system on your car as far as I'm concerned. And when we do an inspection, we check the pads and shoes for thicknesses. We check the rotors and drums.
Get Motorcraft Brake Service with up to $50 in mail-in rebates when you use the Ford Service credit card. Click on the banner ad now. Taxes extra. Rebate by check subject to credit approval. Pads or shoes on most cars and light trucks. One axle. Excludes machining, rotors, or drums. See participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 531-13.
101 WRIF. Lock it in. Everything that rocks.
Detroit. Save the date. Saturday, June 15th, Wolverine Harley Davidson's Harley Fest 2013 returns to Freedom Hill with 101 The Riff.